I was not a very good
spell. I was going to say, I can spell revenue.
The House Committee on Revenue for the Interim House Committee on Revenue for November 17, 2015 will come to order. We have a bunch of informational meetings today, and so we sort of need to power through. The first one is the analysis of Oregon's marginal effective personal income tax rates by LRO. Paul, you want to take off of that one?
Well, we thought we'd start off with something really exciting early.
Right. Keep us all awake.
8 o'clock in the morning. Right. We've had a number of questions over the last few months about how we're familiar with our marginal rate structure, the 5-7-9-9-9 rates, and how that interacts with some of the various phase outs that are in the system, like the federal tax subtraction, the earned income credit, and how they interact in terms of what it really affects people's effective tax rate, which is the amount of taxes they pay relative to their income. So Christine has spent some time going through some examples that she's put together for you, and we'll walk through those. And it's just, there's not necessarily a specific policy response here. It's just to give you a sense of how individual taxpayers are affected by these changes, and to recognize that it's not just the rates themselves that can affect that, how people are affected as their income moves up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Christine Broniak with the Legislative Revenue Office. Yes, I did an analysis of various tax rates. You know, this would be both the overall rate as well as the marginal tax rate. I looked at the interaction with the federal tax subtraction. It's been capped at $6,350 and phased out for incomes between zero and $125,000 and $145,000 for single taxpayers, and between $250,000 and $290,000 for joint taxpayers. And so this subtraction for federal taxes paid is known to make the marginal tax rate a bit lower than it would be or a bit higher rather than it would be without it. I went through, and there's a lot of numbers here, bear with me, but I'll just focus on some transitions. The first taxpayer is just a theoretical person, a single taxpayer, and their income, you can see at, how their situation changes as it goes up from 10,000 all the way through to 150,000, and that's the point where they would not be eligible for any federal tax subtraction anymore. And so at the $10,000 level, they don't have any federal tax. So the overall tax rate is 2.94% and doesn't change by removing the federal tax subtraction. Their marginal tax rate at this point is 7%, and the marginal tax rate without the federal tax subtraction is also 7%. So this federal tax subtraction doesn't start to come into play until a person begins to pay federal tax. That would happen at the level of $20,000 of income. And that's person number two. They have an overall tax rate of 5.46%, and that's just Oregon's tax rate. And so without the federal tax subtraction, that rate would be 5.92%. The marginal tax rate, because of the federal tax subtraction, is 7.65%, and then the statutory rate of 9% is what it would be without the federal tax subtraction. So just a bit of the intuition about what's happening there. The person makes an additional dollar of income, but because that dollar increases the amount of federal taxes that they pay, then they are able to subtract a greater amount. And yes.
So, Mr. Chair, I have a quick question.
Yes, Representative Nose, please.
I'm sorry, I feel like I should know this, but what is the difference between the tax rate and then the marginal tax rate? So, like, I didn't realize that there was a possibility that someone's tax rate in Oregon would be 5.46%. And then it shows later 7.65. So that's what I can't. What's the difference? Where do those two numbers come from?
I think we need a definition.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Nose, the federal, the tax rate is really what the Oregon, it's the Oregon tax that's paid, and that would be less any deductions as well as exemptions.
Okay.
And so that's the tax paid relative to the income.
Okay.
That's sort of the average tax paid. The marginal rate is calculated by taking a person's tax or taking a person's income and changing it, in this case by $100. And so when they make $100 more, I look at how much their tax changes in response to that.
Okay.
So it's more of what does that additional, what's the tax burden on that additional dollar that a person makes, or in this case, $100.
Okay.
So sort of an average versus something that's at the margin. And that marginal tax rate is lower due to the federal tax subtraction. So it goes to 7.65%. It stays at 7.65% through to the $40,000 income level. Increases then to, or decreases to 6.75% at the $50,000 level of income. And that's because that person is into a higher federal tax bracket. That additional dollar of income means that they would pay a little bit more in federal taxes, and then as a result, pay a little bit less in Oregon taxes. And that's why it declines. You'll see right when that person reaches $60,000 of income, they've reached the point where their federal tax is equal to the cap on the federal tax subtraction, and that's $6,350 for that income level. And so what happens there is the federal tax subtraction will affect their overall tax rate and make it a 7.02%, and without the federal tax subtraction it would be higher, nearly 8%. But this is the point where it stops affecting the marginal tax rate, because an additional dollar of income would not result in any more federal tax subtraction, because the person's already maxed out at $6,350 or above in federal tax, and they can't get any more of a subtraction in response to that additional dollar of income. So it goes on like this. You'll see the federal tax subtraction has a reduction on the overall tax rate, and this will continue all the way through to until we get to person 15, who is not eligible for any federal tax subtraction at all at $150,000 in income, and they're able to have a tax rate and a tax rate without the federal tax subtraction of 8.85%. And their marginal tax rate is the statutory rate of 9.9%, and they're not affected by the federal tax rate or federal tax subtraction at all. The next scenario I went through was just for joint taxpayers, and here I did incomes ranging from $20,000 to $300,000 for these theoretical filers who are joint filers. At the $20,000 level, they don't pay any federal tax, so they're not affected by the federal tax subtraction at all. And the overall tax rate is 2.94%. So it's a similar pattern to before in the next income tiers, where the marginal tax rate is affected by the federal tax subtraction for the $40,000 and $60,000 income level, and the federal tax subtraction will reduce that rate at those levels. It's as you get to $80,000, the couple's federal tax would reach the cap of the federal tax subtraction, and that at that point it stops affecting the marginal rate. But it does affect the total rate and reduces it from what it would be otherwise. And then this shows a phase up all the way to $300,000, where the person, the couple was no longer eligible for the federal tax subtraction, and it doesn't affect any of their overall tax rates or marginal tax rates anymore. The next slide, I considered people with, these are single retirees with some proportion of Social Security income and no dependents. And so they have both a total income of ranging from $10,000 up through $150,000. And there is a portion of their income that comes from Social Security and a portion that comes from some other taxable type of retirement income. So I was thinking like maybe a traditional IRA or something that was taxable. And so this is just what their tax rates look like. Oregon does not tax Social Security income at all, although at the federal level, Social Security income over a certain amount has 85% of Social Security income has become taxable if a person's income is sufficiently high. They look at a indicator of provisional income, and they could end up paying tax on up to 85% of their Social Security. And so the federal tax subtraction does end up making a difference in this scenario. Overall, you can see the tax rates are relatively low for people with Social Security income. The Oregon tax rate is, for a person with $20,000 in income, it's at 0.35%. And it would range up to 6% for a person with $150,000 in income. This also shows the similar pattern as before, where the marginal tax rate is affected by the federal tax subtraction up into a point. That would be $70,000 in income, and that's where the federal tax caps out at or goes larger than $6,350. So at this point down here, additional dollars earned do not actually increase the federal tax subtraction. So the marginal tax rate is not affected at this point. Then the overall tax rate, of course, continues to be affected by the federal tax subtraction, and it is reduced quite a bit due to that, and then by the I didn't actually show the income level at which the federal tax subtraction would not be would not be in play there. So it is in play at a higher income level than it would be if a person didn't have Social Security income. The next scenario is just the same for joint filers who have Social Security income. I phased their income up by $20,000 at a time until they got to $300,000. And so it's just a similar pattern with no effect of the federal tax subtraction for people who don't pay federal tax, reduction in the marginal rate for 47, 48, and 49 until the federal tax reaches more than 6,350. Then that doesn't affect the marginal rate anymore, but it does affect the total tax rates and reduces them quite a bit for these individuals. So no discussion about marginal tax rates would be complete without talking a little bit about the earned income tax credit. And this credit is for earners with relatively low incomes. And it phases up to a certain amount of to $491 and at the maximum amount. And then it, as a person's income increases through these levels, it starts to decline in, as a result of that. And so what you can have is effectively some pretty high marginal tax rates on these individuals, because as they make more money, their earned income tax credit begins to phase itself out. So I start here with an individual that makes, or a couple that has three children, so it's a family of five, and they make $15,000 in the first scenario. And so they have no Oregon tax liability, and they receive the refundable credit of 8% of the federal earned income tax credit, and that's $491 that they receive. Their marginal tax rate here is 0% because they are still in the area or the zone where the earned income tax credit is plateaued at $491 for a while there. But as a person reaches $25,000 in income, or as this family reaches $25,000, the EITC starts to phase out. And here at $25,000, it ends up only being worth $12 in their net income tax. So they receive, by having a negative tax, they actually receive money. But the marginal tax rate here for making an additional $50 is 12.36%, and they don't pay a federal tax, so the it's not affected by the marginal rate is not affected by the federal tax subtraction here. And then you can
Representative Smith Warner.
Christine, thank you, Mr. Chair. Christine, can you just say why in these scenarios you used $50 and then the other ones you used $100 for the marginal tax rate?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith Warner. The earned income tax credit, I was just looking it up in a table, and so the table was at $50 increments, and so I was trying to hit the center of that average. And if I added $100, I guess I could have, but I was just trying to get one notch up on the table each time so that it was even,
okay,
numerically. As this couple faces up to $35,000, the effects of their earned income tax credit start to decline as well, but not as steeply. And so they have a 10.76% or 9.86% marginal tax rate as a result of making $50 extra here. And then without the federal tax subtraction, the marginal tax rate is a bit higher. And then it goes on to a couple that makes $45,000, and that marginal tax rate is at 10.76% again, because the EITC is phasing out in kind of proportional ways at this point, so they're even for these two amounts. And then by $55,000, the couple is no longer, or family is no longer eligible to receive the EITC at all, so its impact goes away. However, the federal tax subtraction still affects the tax rate overall, as well as the marginal tax rate for that family.
Okay. Any other questions? I think these tables bear some study to see what they mean and what they might imply for us.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add something. You know, I think the message for you as policymakers is that, you know, a lot of people say, well, Oregon's got this real flat tax rate system. But when you incorporate all these different elements to it, I mean, you do have the marginal rate that the effective marginal rate does vary as you move up those income groups, and it starts at very low levels of income. So your marginal rate is always changing as your income is moving up. And so even though you may be in the 9% marginal bracket in terms of the overall nominal tax rate, when you figure in the federal tax subtraction or some of these other factors, Social Security, then you do have a different marginal rate as you move up that spectrum.
Yes, Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation, and you're absolutely right. It deserves a lot more study. So, Paul, there was an article recently that suggested Oregon's system was one of the fairest in the nation, and the conclusion, of course, is because we don't have a sales tax. And how is that just an anecdotal sort of a remark of mine, or is there a way of drawing that out further in this discussion? because, of course, you look at the low income, and they're actually paying some income tax, but they're not paying any sales tax. So how do we factor that into this conversation?
Vice Chair Benz, Mr. Chair, I think to address that issue of overall equity or fairness in the system, I think you have to look at the distribution of all the taxes. So, and in fact, that's what we're going to do December 2nd. We've updated our OTIM model and we've redone our base distribution of the tax burden. So we've looked at 9 different income groups and allocated each of the taxes, the excise taxes, all the way through the personal income tax, property tax. And that'll give you a sense of at least what we think that distribution is. Now, whether that's fair or not depends on kind of your decisions about what fairness is. But relative to other states, if you just look at our system compared to other state and local systems, we tend to be pretty close to proportional in terms of our overall tax burden, meaning that proportion of our income and taxes is roughly the same. Most states, and of course Washington being the classic example, are regressive, that their effective rate does decline as income rises. So in that sense, and people will say that our system is more fair, well, it's closer to being proportional, but that's fairness, of course, is a subjective term.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oregon's rate on the highest income individuals is only somewhat lower than their rate on the lowest income individuals. And by comparison to other states, that makes us look really good. It's hard to say that we have a progressive tax system using the sort of the base definition of that term, but compared to other states, we do pretty well. I think that's a fair editorial on your comment, isn't it?
I think so. And yeah, I would say our system is roughly proportional.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I remember when we studied the issues when we were looking at Measure 66, we realized that very high income people's tax rate was roughly 6% when you add everything up, and people in the middle were paying a couple of percent more than that, and people at the bottom end slightly more than that, not counting the EITC, and at the very, very bottom end where we actually have negative rates. Anything else on this issue for today? This is sort of homework background information as we look at policy issues later. Thank you very much. And Paul, we're 3 minutes ahead.
Okay, and I'm going to ask Christine to come up, because she's been working on this next issue.
Okay. Unpaid debt collections, House Bill 2089, implementation, Department of Revenue.
Chair, members of the committee. So Deanna Mack is here today to talk about the implementation of HB 2089 that would somewhat provide some guidelines around the way that income tax debt, outstanding income tax debt, is collected from people in various circumstances with various types of income.
All right.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and I was asked to come in here from a regular session to give you an update on the progress that the department has made on implementing House Bill 2089 and some other collections-related features. As you know, House Bill 2089 passed by this committee in the 2015 session, and it provides the department an opportunity to give low-income taxpayers or low-income debtors who have limited assets and income from sources exempt from garnishment an ability to put their account, their collection account, in hold status for up to a year, no more than 3 years. The taxpayer must have less than $5,000 in assets. And that was one of the things that we had testified we would work with proponents on, defining what assets meant. So we actually have we're in the process of adopting an administrative rule to define assets. The rule is currently out for review in advance of a public hearing we're holding on November 23rd. It's on our website. Assets for this purpose do not include the value of the debtor's primary residence and the land it's on in one vehicle. Like the federal government, we will not make a judgment call on whether there is equity in the home or not. So bottom line, these folks get to keep one home and one vehicle, regardless of the value of those items, and they're secure in keeping the home they live in and the car they need for transportation. Okay. Household goods and personal effects of the debtor will also not count towards the $5,000 limit. This is also directly tied to the CFR, to the code of the federal law. This protects items such as heirloom wedding rings, engagement rings, personal property like that. It doesn't go so far as to protect, like, say, an expensive piece of art on the wall. That is not considered a household good. Household goods are ordinary, used in the day-to-day operations of your home, like your kitchen appliances, your mixers, that kind of stuff. Also exempt from the $5,000 limit is the value of burial spaces, burial funds up to $1,500 for the debtor and their immediate family members, life insurance policies, the value of grants, fellowships, scholarships, or gifts that are set aside for to pay educational expenses of the debtor. So none of those things count towards the $5,000 limit. Many of the federal protections that are provided for are also provided for under Oregon law. However, sometimes the federal protections are less lenient. So what we plan to do where there is conflict is allow the more lenient value. And that is set forth in the rule as well. The limits set forth in the statute do require that there's an evaluation process by the department to determine whether the debtor actually qualifies for the suspended status. But that's basically what we do now. We have a form to do that. There is no specific appeal for the department's decision. However, the debtor can just reapply and provide additional information, or if their financial circumstances change or worsen, they can just reapply for the status and we can consider them again. It still remains very, very important for the debtor to contact us, because we just simply do not know what their financial condition is until they contact us and tell us that. So it's we urge them to do so. We've also changed forms, instructions, and letters. We're in the process of updating the financial statement form. It's going to be available on Revenue Online for people to fill out online as part of our new Gentax rollout, which is happening on December 1st. We have to have income and asset information in order to determine if they qualify for the status or some other action, such as cancellation and total. The financial statement will be available for folks to use online if they choose. They can use it, and if they do use it online, it cuts down all of the information, like if they're only wage earners and they don't have, or they have other sorts of types of income, it'll take it down to a simple form automatically versus a more complex form for business folks. We also created a brochure to help educate debtors specifically about our collections process. That was something that came out that we don't have a lot of information on our website. So it basically is a do and don't kind of thing. Don't be afraid to contact us kind of thing. Do acknowledge that you have to deal with this kind of thing. So that's going to be available after December 1st as well. It's in final production, should hopefully be out there with our web conversion after the Revenue Online. We have three letters that are going out as a result of this particular action, because the bill actually required that we give them 30 days notice if we take them off of suspended status, so we had to create some new letters to do that. Those are almost ready to go. We are also in the process of amending or correcting or updating all of our policy and procedures that are related to collections actions. There are a lot of them. A lot of them are being updated because we're changing from our current system to the Gentax system. So all of the way we do our work is changing. So as we're updating those staff procedures, we're also updating them to accommodate this new temporary collection status. We also talked about staff training back in June. By the end of December, we will have training material prepared and training sessions scheduled for frontline staff that are directly affected by this new review process. Again, it's effective January 1. Collectors will have awareness training so they can educate debtors about suspended collections. And we're also in the middle of a procurement process to obtain training for all staff related to emotional intelligence or empathy training. We have piloted a training module and have moved past the pilot stage and hope to have the agency-wide training next year. The goal of this training is to help ensure that staff recognize cues from taxpayers so that our agents can read between the lines to better figure out and resolve the debt with whatever the best options are. Sometimes people aren't exactly forthright with the things they need to say, and we need to train our staff to pick up on that. Household income tables, there is a requirement that they be the household have less than 200% of federal poverty guidelines. So we have those are available on the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. These are the ones that if you can see the column for the 200% for the 48 states based on family size. You're looking at somebody, a single person who has less than $23,000, $540 of income that is like Social Security or veterans benefits, those kinds of incomes, less than that threshold, and they would qualify for that. These are drafts. We'll have the final ones published for staff and for taxpayers to see come January. Excuse me. Household income is based on existing standards in Oregon law. So to figure out what goes into household income, we're just going to tie to the low-income assistance under elderly rental assistance. We've already got tables of types of income that goes in and out of the calculation. So we'll refer to that, and we'll have that published as well.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, yes, please, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much. Deanna, can you just clarify the draft guidelines? Did you say those were essentially the federal guidelines?
Mr. Chair and Representative Davis, yes, those are the federal guidelines, and we will probably just take them and actually finalize them from our research section usually publishes all our numbers, and we just went and got this from the federal site. There's a couple different sources for this, the Census Bureau and the Health and Human Services. I'm not sure which one they actually certify, but this is the one from the Health and Human Services.
And this is... It's draft for purposes of Department of Revenue. It's final for purposes of the federal government.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Correct. I'm not sure which one they go to for our numbers.
And to follow up on that, can you give us the considerations for why you would use a particular set of numbers or why you might modify a particular set of numbers for the purpose of this process that we're talking about today?
Mr. Chair, I wish I could tell you the difference between the Health and Human Services and the Census Bureau numbers. I'm not an economist. I don't know the difference.
I'm really asking a different question.
Oh, okay.
And that is, I guess maybe there's two parts to it. Do you expect that you'd adopt one of these sets of numbers or that you would modify it in some way? If you would modify it in some way, how and why?
Mr. Chair, we would not modify it. We would just adopt the numbers, the federal numbers.
Great. Thank you. I misunderstood what you said earlier. All right.
Any other questions about that material so far? Since the June hearings, there are some things that we promised that we would do that are not related directly to this bill. Although they are directly related to collections. The first thing that we updated was we added language in our notice and demand for payment that said if you have income that's exempt from garnishment, such as Social Security or some other source like veterans benefits or disability benefits, to contact us and let us know that. So it's in the notice, and it's been in production, I think, since May or June. We also put the same information in your rights as an Oregon taxpayer, and we have the Taxpayer Bill of Rights in Chapter 305, and we are required to create a publication that tells taxpayers what their reasonable rights are, what there's not every single right that they're entitled to under every law in Oregon, but the most common ones. And
excuse me just a moment, Representative Vance.
Do you have that new notice and demand language? Because I think that was the... Yeah, that'd be helpful. So I would like to see it, so...
Yes, I can actually probably get that for you fairly easily.
That would be good. Thank you.
Your rights as an Oregon taxpayer brochure has been updated to explain when the income is protected, certain incomes are protected from garnishment. We also, as I mentioned before, we created an educational brochure that's nearly final, and that wasn't required as part of House Bill 2089, but we felt that it was important to help people understand what the collections process was, what kind of letters we're going to be sending them, what kind of contact we'll be making. When we do make contact, what they need to tell us, such as, we're going to be asking for your Social Security number, don't be surprised, that kind of thing. And if they don't contact us, we've explained what the collections process is, such as the fact that we'll continue to send notices and then up to and including garnishment, and that it's very important that they contact us. So that's out, that will be out there. As I said, we've made progress on the staff training for the emotional intelligence. We really want people to understand and have empathy for these folks' situations. The department has maybe a different philosophy about collecting debt than other. We aren't doing this as a percentage. We don't get paid as a percentage of what we collect. We have a goal of voluntary compliance long term, so we want to have folks in the system and compliant, and so we do other things to help them resolve debt, such as entering into the long-term payment plans or even considering cancellation or write-off if the circumstances are correct right. And then lastly, we're updating all of our notices to make them more readable, more understandable as part of our Gentax conversion, which we go live on December 1st. The notices in the past have been almost a micro font. They've come out of state printing. They're difficult to read. They're definitely they left a lot to be desired, and we were bound by the current system to do in how we do our notices. Of course, there's some legal language that we have to have in the notices, but the notices now in Gentax, there's a lot more flexibility, and the font size is bigger. It's something it's more like a regular letter. It's not so mean and ugly. It's not so difficult to read, and I think it's you'll be pleased when you start seeing the notices coming out, because we are going to be able to send a lot more notices in Gentax to taxpayers, including statements of accounts. So your constituents will see a lot more notices from us on there. So our goal is just to effectively collect the debt that's owed to the state. We want to prioritize our resources to collect the debt that in the most effective way to help fund the services for Oregonians, to which they've become accustomed. So if you have any questions at all, I'm happy to answer them.
Yes, sir.
So or try.
Thanks for being here. I was wondering if you've broken down which counties have the most individuals that have back debt for seniors.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsett, we don't know the age of all our taxpayers, but we could probably find out by address what the debt balances are for all taxpayers by county.
Would you mind?
Yeah, I can get that for you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative
House. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. Maybe you guys covered this during the regular session, but I just got back on the committee. How much is in arrears or owed to the state, and then how many people are in this situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nose, the balance of debt that the Department of Revenue has right now is for the income tax programs, I think is about $750 million. The total state debt that agencies are collecting on is, I think the published number is $3.2 billion. Mm-hmm. A lot of that debt is debt for, say, for child support, for justice, the court system, restitution, things that are not directly due to the state. They're due to victims or custodial parents.
Okay.
But the state is charged with collecting those things. But the funds that are due to the Department of Revenue actually has responsibility for is the personal income tax or the income tax programs of 750-ish million. And then we also have other agencies that have assigned debt to us that's valued at about, I think, 250. We have about $1 billion that we collect for the state out of the total debt balance. The judicial department, they collect quite a bit. In fact, I think they have the highest balance. I think the Department of Justice collects for the child support program. Several agencies collect on their own, but then we collect through our other agency accounts function the balance.
Thank you.
And then how many people do you think are owe taxes to the state of Oregon in that $750 million? Do you have any idea?
It's in the, Mr. Chair, Representative Nose, it's in the legislative fiscal report, fiscal office report, LFO, for the liquidated and delinquent for 2000. I think the most recent one was published that, I want to say that 2014.
Okay.
So that would be I want to say it's a few hundred thousand,
okay.
But it's published number. I just don't remember it.
So fine. I'll look it up. Thank you.
Interesting. You know, and of course, when we're talking about these debts, the numbers are very large, and when you're dealing with debt owed to the court system, you have to think about where that debt came from and how much of it's likely to be collected.
Right.
It would be wonderful if we were managed to collect all of it, but the odds of doing that are pretty low when you figure who owes it and why and what their likelihood of earning income to make those payments is. And, of course, that's part of the dilemma that you face every day, isn't it, is to recognize people's circumstances change and earnings that they had a couple of years ago, which incurred debt, tax debt, they may not now be able to pay.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair, one more point about the balances of the debt. That's the liquidated and delinquent debt, which means it's aged to a certain point. There's some statutory definitions of that. But we actually collect, I think, I want to say the number is close to almost $5 billion is what is owed to the state. And we collect that difference effectively and within a short time period. So there's a substantial amount of money that we handle that we do collect in a very short period of time that doesn't ever get to the liquidated and delinquent level, which we call our healthy AR. We get it in and we get it out as quickly as possible. And that's over, it's a couple, almost, I want to say a little over $1.5 billion a year.
And a lot of that, I'm sure, is you filed a tax return, you made this error, now you owe us $212.50, would you pay mm-hmm. it today? Mm-hmm. And they do, mm-hmm. and that goes away.
Yes, we yeah. resolve it within a short window of time, and it never gets to that definition of liquidated and delinquent.
Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Chair. And Deanna, thanks again for updating us. I'd like to ask that you could follow up with the committee, or at least a few of us who've asked, but I think everyone on the committee would probably benefit with a couple things. One is the statute or the rules definition of assets that are going to be exempt. So the list that you read to us, I think it'd be helpful to actually have that list.
Okay.
Second is the updated language on the notice and demand for payment and your rights as a taxpayer brochure. And then the updated GenTax notices when those are available. Because I think the genesis of this was a belief that taxpayers, low-income taxpayers in particular, those who had exempt income, were not receiving sufficient notice of their right to not submit those assets to the Department of Revenue or not use those assets. So I think we'd like an update about what the notices look like and what taxpayers are going to be experiencing in the next tax collection period going forward.
We can do that, Mr. Chair. Much of this is available online. The rule is online, which I sent the information to the chair of the committee as required for the rules process. It's on our website. I'm happy to get that for you.
Thank you.
But for the citizens, if they want to look at it, your rights as an Oregon taxpayer is also on our website. Simply Google that term, that phrase, and it will show up. It's one of the first responses. And I'm happy to get the copy of the notices. The GenTax notices will include the copy of the notice that I referred to, the notice in demand for payment.
Thank you very much.
And mm-hmm. if you would work with LRO yep. on that, we'll make sure then that every member of the committee gets that information. Representative Davis is exactly right. Mm-hmm. A big chunk of the reason why we ended up with the bill was because of issues having to do with the way the notice was written and what information it actually imparted. Is that fair? Okay. Other? Thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate the update very much. It looks to me as though things are on track.
Thank you.
And we're, again, ahead of schedule, which is good.
Yeah. All right. Amazing.
Modernizing property tax assessment techniques. Lane County. Is Lane County here? Nobody's. Ah. Here they come. Gentlemen, thank you. We're running a little fast today, so we appreciate your being prepared to go early.
Good
Hal, do you want to introduce this panel?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We do have on OLIS, there's a number of documents that this panel will be speaking about. They're all titled Lane County, so that's kind of your note of how to get to them. But we do have Lane County, the Lane County Assessor, as well as we have a few individuals, I should say, actually, that are going to be talking about a little bit of a project that happened in the past, and I believe may also still be ongoing as well, a little bit about some joint government work, if you will. And the name we have up there is a little bit of a placeholder, so I think they can give a better title of what the actual project was. But with that, I'll go ahead and hand it over to them.
Good morning.
Thank you.
And welcome.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager, and we are here to talk to you about something called the Southwest Oregon Assessment and Taxation Coalition. With me today is Mike Coles, our assessor from Lane County, and Jim Johnson, the Deputy Director of Operations for the National Policy Consensus Center out of PSU. We each played a role in putting this coalition together. Mine was in the building and implementation and sort of the lubricant of getting everybody together and talking was the role of Portland State. I wanted to just begin giving you an overview of Lane County's fiscal situation and mention that, you know, Lane County is an interesting place in that we get, in terms of regions, we get talked about in different ways depending on the topic. In the news today and over the last couple of days has been justice reinvestment. We are part of that metropolitan what's called the RIC, the Metro RIC. So we join with Multnomah, in that case, Washington, Clackamas, and Lane make up that urban region in terms of public safety, the metropolitan region. For regional solutions, we partner with Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln counties. But we really have actually a great deal of affinity with the southwestern Oregon counties due to the presence of the ONC forests of western Oregon. The ONC is just an incredibly fascinating history in Oregon. It's been incredibly important for those counties. There's 18 ONC counties, but the counties to the south and southwest of us, we've really relied on that revenue to a high degree. When the spotted owl was listed in the late 80s, we really saw timber harvest decline, and that had just a hugely deleterious effect on the revenues coming into Lane County. The thing that we share, unfortunately, is a low permanent rate. Because we had so much timber revenue coming in during the 70s and 80s, there was really, when measures 5 and 50 hit and locked that permanent rate in, we were locked into a relatively low rate that wasn't quite contemplated what would happen if that timber revenue went away. One of the other things that we share is a difficulty in passing local revenue measures. And the chart that I have before you today is a chart that was put together by the Secretary of State's office. They've done two different research reports on counties' fiscal health in Oregon, one in 2012 and one in 2014. This is the one from 14. There are counties to monitor as a result of this report because of the fiscal challenges we face. And of the seven counties that we are talking about today, actually six of those counties are on that counties to monitor list. And one of the things you'll see is that we have a very small local revenue per capita. So Lane and Josephine are in the bottom two. Those are actually partners in this coalition. You've got Douglas, another partner, Jackson, Curry, Coos, all partners. This really puts these counties into the sort of the top 10 or the bottom 10, however you want to characterize it. And then our little bit of an outlier is Klamath County. The other slide that I wanted to show you was to give you just a sense of where our revenues come from, sort of the bigger chunks of revenue. And in this slide, on the bar chart here, what you're looking at are federal forest dollars. And the important thing to know is what I've done here is divided this into decades of looking at this. And so you can see we've got the decade of the 70s over here, the 80s here. These are actual harvest years where we were sharing in that revenue. And this general fund dollars are the ONC dollars. So the ONC is interesting in that it brings completely discretionary dollars into the counties, whereas the national forest revenue is strictly for schools and roads. So those are dedicated dollars. But your general fund dollars here in the 70s and 80s were from actual harvest. It wasn't until we started getting into the 90s that we saw what we called safety net legislation, where as a result of the owl being listed, there were federal policies that propped up counties by providing them some temporary revenue. And then in the, really what I characterize as the 2000s, the decade of the 2000s, that was the decade of SRS, Secure Rural Schools. And what I want the committee to understand is that even though it was a changed source of money from the U.S. Treasury, it still came to us via the National Forest and via the BLM for the ONC revenue. So we still saw that same split of dedicated money for roads and dedicated money for general fund. What's been a little frustrating here now as we get into the decade of the 2010s is that SRS has been much less consistent. October 1st of this year, SRS is gone. So again, the counties in this area find themselves with a very uncertain history with, or excuse me, an uncertain future with respect to these very, what had been very large sources of revenue. The other thing that happened in the latter part, or the early part of this decade, was that when Congress was able to reauthorize SRS, there were ramp downs that were mandated into those reauthorizations. So we saw SRS that was reflective of historical timber harvest then start to get an artificial ramp down overlaid by policymakers. So SRS has become very uncertain, as I said, future for us.
Yeah, Representative, what's it?
Question on the last column. If that is an extrapolation out to 2019 or 2020, or if we're just looking at half because it's half of the amount that we've collected so far.
Right. Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsitt, that is the latter.
Okay.
It is just too current.
So we can look at double that then, essentially, if things were to go forward.
Well, right. And what will happen as things move forward is we will go back to actual harvest revenue, which is why I put this line on, because this shows federal forest harvest in the state of Oregon. And you can see how it's declined on both national forest and BLM lands. And so when we go back to that actual harvest revenue, the numbers are really dismal, unfortunately. And so we continue to advocate at the federal level for forest policy changes. So the last part of the slide that I wanted you to be aware of was our property tax revenue. And this is, I unfortunately just can't find accurate enough records going back to the 70s. It gets getting to some pretty old budget documents. But this shows our trajectory of property tax revenue. And in 2013, Lane County was able to actually pass a money measure for jails only. So while it's general fund dollars, it's dedicated general fund. So it has to go just to support our jail, and it's a five-year local option levy. In 2015, we actually tried to pass a vehicle registration fee to sort of make up for this road fund problem that we're also having as a result of the federal forest policy. And that vehicle registration fee proposal was really soundly defeated by the voters. And I can't help but note that it would have wrapped in electric vehicle owners, Mr. Chair. But,
thank you. We did lead you into a trap because we passed a law some years ago to allow you to do exactly what you tried to do.
Yeah.
And with that, we probably owe you an apology for having lured you to try something that wasn't going to pass
well,
in the county.
Well, my observation, I think it's still a relatively new funding mechanism,
yeah.
And we haven't seen really any success around the state, but it's I think a lot of it is that people don't quite understand it the way they do a property tax local option measure. So I think the point of that I wanted to set in terms of the stage is to show you how important now this property tax revenue is for these counties. And this dynamic that I'm describing today, I think you could produce a chart like this for the other counties that are involved in this project and see a very similar story. A lot of ONC revenue in the past that's declined, some Forest Service revenue in Southern Oregon that's declined, property tax that has grown slightly. We've been actually fairly successful, but for example, the other county that I showed, Josephine County, has tried on a number of occasions a couple of different money measures without success. Klamath County recently without success. Curry County multiple times without success. So we've really got this dynamic in Southern Oregon that it is a very difficult challenge. Part of it is that Congress does, from time to time, without a whole lot of notice, reauthorize SRS, and that becomes a terrible headline where you're in the middle of a campaign to ask taxpayers and Congress has given you some money. So at any rate, my point was is that the property tax system is incredibly important for us, and we have seen over the years the assessor's office in Lane County go through some struggles. When we were really having to cut our budgets in this as SRS was declining, we made some pretty dramatic cuts in the assessor's office to the point where the State Department of Revenue came in and said, we may not give you your CAFA grant. I think the committee is familiar with CAFA. And the other dynamic around CAFA was that in 2009, the state eliminated the $5 million general fund contribution to CAFA. So as a result, we've seen CAFA, which was designed to cover about 40% or so of those offices' activities, has reduced in our case, I think, to just under 20% now. And, so my sort of closing pitch is anything the legislature can do to reinstate those CAFA dollars, I think we'd be very grateful for that activity. That was, again, a result of the recession, and there was a lot of that sort of sweeping of various funds going on at the time. Interestingly, I think you'd see that in the record there was some discussion of eventually putting it back into play, and that has yet to happen. The other thing that I will mention, and I don't know the future of it, but there has been a proposal floated around refer a constitutional amendment to the voters that would create a $2 minimum property tax in Oregon. And for us, for example, we've got $1.28 as a permanent rate. We added 55 cents as a local option. And putting us up to $2 on the permanent side of things would give us a little bit even more than that local option did and would be exceedingly helpful for our county in particular, and I think the rest of the counties as well, albeit perhaps not very popular with the taxpayer in our counties that have been reluctant to take advantage of pitches made by their county commissioners. So with that, I'm going to turn this presentation over to Jim to give you a little bit more context around how this project came into being and sort of what its framework has been.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Johnson. I'm the Deputy Director for Operations at the National Policy Consensus Center at Portland State University. NPCC is the home to the Oregon Solutions Program and to the Oregon Consensus Programs. Mike Coles, the assessor for Lane County, is going to cover the bulk of the presentation today. And what Mike's going to be talking about is a pilot program in assessment and taxation in personal property processing. The way this, the history behind this pilot project is rather interesting. In 2013, in around March or so, Commissioner Sid Lykin from Lane County, Mike MacArthur from AOC, and Greg Wolf from NPCC decided to get together and talk about, are there any efficiencies that we can gain in assessment and taxation in our 36 counties? As you're well aware, basically all 36 counties are doing the same thing. The assessment and taxation laws are pretty much state laws, and all 36 are doing about the same. So is there a way that we can work together gain some efficiencies and some innovation in the way we do this? We got a number of counties together. Principally, it was Coos, Curry, Douglas, Jackson, Josephine, Klamath, and Lane. Those seven counties got together, both commissioners and assessors, to talk about the general subject of efficiencies and innovations in assessment and taxation. After that meeting, we did some brainstorming, generated about 33 ideas or so on that may have some benefit. May have some efficiencies to be gained. During that year, we talked to the counties about a number of ways to approach this. What we advise them is that you should get together as a group and actually form a coalition, put together a memorandum of understanding where you are telling the state, we are going to work together as a group of seven counties to do some different things. So we help them with that memorandum of understanding, and essentially it's a governance document on how they will work together as a group of seven counties, with the seven assessors being the policy group, with their staff assisting them in working together to deliver these services rather than each individually going their own way. So with that memorandum of understanding, we started some meetings and started to take those 33 general ideas and narrow them down. We came up with four that we thought would gain the most efficiency and were some innovative things that we could do with them. Essentially, they were sharing commercial and industrial appraisers between counties. Secondly was taking property tax exemption processing and centralizing that in one county and that county providing that service for all of the rest of the six counties. The one Mike's going to talk about is business personal property tax processing. The fourth one that we talked about was working together on A&T hardware and software. Again, an area that Lane County is very familiar with. So those four ideas became sort of the ideas that we started working on with quite a bit of work. We put together a proposal and made a presentation to Chairman Devlin and Buckley of the Joint Ways and Means Committee and asked for some dollars to assist us with this pilot project. None of the seven counties had the seed money in order to do this, so we asked for more than $500,000. After some discussion, it was decided that we'd take on two of these four pilot projects, and the money was reduced to $354,000. What we've done is stretch that over a two-year period and done two pilot projects. The business personal property tax processing, and then the sharing of the commercial and industrial appraisers between counties. Once the money was allocated, there were a number of intergovernmental agreements that needed to be done. There's a scope of work to make sure that the state is getting the services that we told you that we would be providing. So those intergovernmental agreements were negotiated. They were put in place with DAS, and the dollars were allocated then. The role of NPCC is to do an evaluation to help the seven counties think about how this was done and help them document and provide a toolkit to other counties who may want to duplicate the work that has been done in Lane County. What's been interesting about this project is not only working through all of the interesting political issues related to a coalition of seven counties, seven assessors, working with those different counties and their approaches and how they do things. and the politics around changes of assessors as they go through election processes, and one will change, and we have to then continue the discussion about this coalition and what it means to work together as a group of seven assessors. So it has been rather interesting to do it. I can tell you very clearly that it would not have been done without the assistance of the state of Oregon. The seed money that was provided was critical in order to making this project work. And I think what Mike is going to show you is that although we have not finished the evaluation yet, there is some success that we can talk about today. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mike and get into some of the details about how this works.
Good morning, Representative Barnhard, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm Mike Coles, Lane County Assessor. I am going to start out just giving a quick synopsis of three main points that I want to make if I get to any of the items today. The first point is the project, as Alex and Jim talked about, is collaboration and working together. And it's not only collaboration and working together of Lane County and the six other counties, but working together with Jim Portland and Alex, working together with Department of Revenue, working with the Oregon Lottery, working with DAS, working with the private industry sector, working with industry groups, numerous agencies and groups that we worked with in this collaboration effort. Implementation of the project, it's not easy to start a project from scratch. Even with seed money from the state, we essentially had to ramp up and hire staff and use existing staff to start the personal property program. We were very frugal in that effort. The area that we used, we decided it would be best to have a isolated separate office area for the staff to work in, and to do that we used a area that Lane County had vacated from Land Management Division. County facilities graciously donated that area for 1 year, and then we extended that to the 2 year period at no charge to the project. The staffing, we've used retirees and industry experts, and mostly a part-time and some full-time help to help make the project a success and make it from a 1 year to a 2 year project. The computers, the office furniture that we used were all reclaimed from prior office areas, so no funds were spent on the computers or office furniture. We spent weekends setting things up on essentially our own time, working as again as a team to get the project set up and off the ground. That said, once the project got started, you really need a kind of a roadmap to decide what the best method is to look at a program and programs from the counties that have really had little hands-on work besides a self-reporting system. Let me step back a little bit. Personal property returns are typically sent out by the counties, and it's the self-reporting system. Being a self-reporting system, there is really no checkpoint or audit side. It's a process that there, I cane it to the income tax, where there's always an audit side, and without an audit side or without a review side, there wouldn't be very good compliance. Secondly, a lot of businesses and industry groups really didn't know about the reporting requirements for business personal property. They thought either that it was for either the larger businesses or their accountants told them otherwise. And so a big part of the project was the education component. Starting up the project, we had to establish a database of all the businesses, and originally it was all seven counties. We used a private sector information to establish that database, and then use information services to work on a program to isolate businesses that potentially have not been reporting. I'm going to go ahead and move to the next slide, successes. In doing that, we really developed, I believe, breaking ground as far as, one, using private sector information to find and educate businesses of their obligations to report under business personal property requirements, to let them know of the refiling requirements, and to also follow up and answer questions as they had many questions. We set up a line at Lane County that all the counties could call Lane County. The letters that went out all came back for the phone number for our staff to answer, which helped give similar answers to questions, which was very important. It was a very interesting project. It is very challenging. As previously noted, our staff has been whittled down over the years, and our funds and budget, but this really gave us a jump start. It gave us a start that would not have happened without the funds from the state. And I have actually concrete numbers as far as, and these are just preliminary numbers. The project is still going on. It started again as a one-year project. We stretched it to a two-year project using the same funding. We have seen that the jumpstart provided and the funds provided, and by educating the businesses, by sending out information, by contacting the businesses, and making them aware of their obligations, that you will see a return on your investment. And we did see a return on our investment, looking at the short term over a one-year period. And I'll go ahead and go to the next slide. The initial investment specifically for the personal property project was around $252,000. Two things that I'd like to point out. One, it's the businesses that are now reporting that were not reporting. Now it's a perpetual return year after year. So now they're on the tax roll. We've also learned in collection enhancements. At the same time, always being business friendly. One of the big concepts that going into the project was that we didn't want to be an enforcement or an agency that would look at causing any detriment to small businesses or large businesses. More looking at an equal playing field. You have three or four businesses, two of them are paying personal property taxes, two of them are not. There's a competitive disadvantage or an advantage, which depending on how you look on it. And just by making the business aware of their obligation to pay their personal property taxes and to file, that was a very large benefit of the project. The general impact on the personal property roll, we saw about a 5% increase in personal property values, but we isolated down returns that are directly attributable to the District 1 personal property project. And the first year attributable was around $190,000 in billed actual tax dollars directly attributable to the project. And that, relative terms, may not sound like a lot, and especially when you look at how much Lane County gets and the other counties receive. Out of that $190,000, the county only receives around $21,000. And that's really one of the big crux of a lot of the problems, is the investment that has to be put forward by the county. The return on investment is very difficult. But when you look at it in a holistic approach, look at the school districts, the local cities, the fire districts, and all the other districts, you look at the return of $190,000, and then over a five-year period, that's close to $1 million in tax revenue that's received by the counties and school districts and local jurisdictions. The project really brought to light, and this was a hypothesis that we knew in advance, but it was nice to know and being proved out that it's difficult for the counties themselves to invest in the property tax system and for assessment. But as the holistic approach of looking at the entire, all the districts that receive the property tax dollars, again, with the help from the state, the return on investment is there, and it was there, and it'll continue to get better as far as the project completes. And I'll go, I know I'm going a little long here, but some of the challenges, a new project, Lane County kind of got it by default. One of the counties that was going to do the personal property project had some changes in their leadership, so Lane County took the project on. Funding and time, it's difficult to ramp up a project in a short period of time. That's one reason why it's a two-year project, but I think that to be a project that's successful, it really needed to be a two-year project. Misconceptions, again, as I spoke about, businesses, talking to a number of businesses and a number of accounting firms and doing presentations, that the misconception is that we're picking on the small businesses, and that's exactly the opposite. We're trying to make sure that, everyone's on equal footing, everyone's paying their fair share of property taxes, and there's no amount of funds that in our limited budgets and our limited assessment system that are left on not on the table, or we can't actually assess. We learned putting forms and letters together, learned a lot about the threshold accounts. The threshold accounts being accounts that are below 16.5 in their assessed value. Numerous properties that we did send correspondence to were below the threshold, but without contacting the businesses that were potentially not on the tax roll, there was really no way to distinguish between some of the larger businesses and some of the smaller businesses on the reporting side.
What's the implication of the threshold?
The threshold is if the businesses is, Chair Barnhart, if the business is being assessed or self-reporting at $16,500, their taxes actually canceled and there is no tax on the account. If it's above $16,500, they're actually taxed on the real market value or the assessed value of the account. And it's important because some of the small businesses, such as small accounting firms, businesses out of homes, they routinely fall under that threshold. And that threshold's changed over the years. I believe it 10 years ago was around $10,000, and it's slowly crept up there's an index that it follows each year. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, sure. So the threshold has to do with whether you pay the tax. Does it have anything to do with whether you have to file the return?
The businesses still have to file the return regardless if they're under the threshold or not. The main purpose of that thinking is that the businesses either they tend to grow and hopefully thrive, and they replace assets, and so businesses that may be under the threshold may be over the threshold the next year. Let's see. I'm going to go ahead and move to the next steps of the project. We've worked really hard last year and a half, 2 years, and we've developed many different resources that not only counties in the MOU and the IGA can use, but resources that other counties can use, including the process we went through to jumpstart a personal property programs that really were neglected over the years. And being a new process, so we've developed a plan of action that other counties can use, a database other counties can use, scripts that for our databases that actually do a lot of processing automatically to compare businesses on the tax roll to businesses that potentially are not on the tax roll. That work has been done, developed, and is right now is being documented and will be ready to use by other counties. And the return on an investment shows not only for personal property, but I believe for general assessment, for real property, for the 36 counties, is that a small investment does have a return, not only for the local jurisdiction themselves, but more importantly, the school districts, local jurisdictions, and again, it has to be looked at in a holistic approach. In conclusion, overall, the project, although still in process, is, I believe, a large success. There's always challenges with any a new project, but we developed relationships with the different counties, again, the jurisdictions, and enhanced the revenue at the same time.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, all of you, for that presentation. That's. I mean, I think your point about the return on investment going beyond the counties, and because even if it doesn't accrue directly to the county coffers, it is accruing to the county and to the general health of the county, those fire districts, those school districts, all that. So I think that's a really important point. Can you talk a little bit, and I may have missed this in the beginning, so it sounded like it was initially all seven counties in the southwest, or in the southwest corner, and then it ended up kind of being the upside down, or well, I'm trying to think of how you would draw that, and kind of how it got there, and what the prospects are for maybe involving those other counties again.
Okay. Representative Warner, members of the committee, Jim Johnson from NPCC. The history is we started focusing on Coos Curry, Douglas, Jackson, Josephine, Klamath, and Lane, those seven southwest Orion counties. After the project started, we made presentations to each of the counties saying, would you like to participate? Lane County is going to provide these services to the other six counties. We need to have you enter into an intergovernmental agreement so that this county can enter into yours and provide these services. A number of the counties decided that that wasn't in their best interest, that they were listening to a number of folks who were in the audience on those particular days who said, we don't want to participate in that program. Small businesses are taxed enough. We don't want to do it. So even though we tried to point out that level playing field, this is already state law. We're just asking that everybody comply. In the end, on some split votes, it was decided not to participate. And that was totally up to them. So in the end, four of the seven counties participated in this program. The other pilot that I didn't talk much about is sharing of commercial and industrial appraisers. That has also been a success. Coos County is sharing its commercial appraiser with Curry County. Curry County can't hire commercial appraisers. They're not part of the state. They're just many more opportunities elsewhere for commercial appraisers. So sharing was the way to do it for them to comply with the law and provide that service. So again, the politics entered into it a little bit. In the end, though, four counties wanted to do it.
Brief follow-up?
Please, yes.
Thank you. And just to go back, has there been any discussion about reapproaching those other counties?
Yes, we will do that. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you.
Others? Yeah, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What percentage of the land mass that we're talking about here is actually owned by the federal government? Could you talk about the sum total of these counties that are in play here? Roughly.
I can take a stab at that. Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I'll get you that data because I do have it here somewhere. But you know, in Lane County, for example, we're at 55% federal and state ownership. I want to say Josephine is a very large at 78%+. And right. Jim, you may know.
Sorry, it's at least that.
Yeah. So these are highly forested areas of the state, and again, I mean, it's sort of this interesting history of what happened between federal forest policy and statewide tax policy that put these counties into a world of hurt, unfortunately.
Appreciate all the efforts that you've gone to out of, frankly, desperation, I think, just to try to continue to keep your head above water. But I think we have to keep in mind that it's a result of, I would say at best, questionable federal management of those lands that began with the listing of the owl but continues to this day with keeping that land mass off limits for producing the renewable resource and the revenue that at one point in time kept all the engines running and all the gears functioning and kids in school and full instructional years and all that type of stuff. That's gone. So you're left grasping at straws, if you will, to try to make ends meet and so forth. And I think we just ought to continue to recognize that for what it is.
And Chairman Barnhart, if I may, we've invested a lot in federal lobbying. Coalition building. I mean, we've literally had national coalitions taking a run at either getting an SRS reauthorization or what we see in the future under the present makeup of Congress is very little appetite for secure rural schools and sort of a continued dole out of dollars from the Treasury when there is so much natural resource available. There's a fairly interesting bill that has passed the House that would provide for some little bit of streamlining with respect to getting sales to the marketplace. We are awaiting a hearing in the Senate, and whether that can be accomplished in this next Congress is going to be, or this next session of this Congress will be something that we're all keeping our eyes on.
One follow-up.
Yeah, please.
Are there any locally owned forest lands in these counties? And I guess the reason I ask is in Hood River County, we've got about 88,000 acres that we have we manage as a renewable resource. About every 80 years, every tree, merchantable tree on that land is going to get harvested. And that revenue comes back into the county coffers to pay for road maintenance and all kinds of other things that really help. It's a sustainable stream of revenue. And I don't know whether these counties, I mean, I'm sure they've looked at that.
Representative Johnson, the Coos County, I know, has a county forest, but it's also subject to many of the federal Marble Muriel Act and other environmental regulations.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dallas.
So I'm new, and I don't understand a lot about forest policy and how all this works together. It's fascinating to me, but I confess I don't understand it very well at this point. If none of this is going to change politically, if we're sort of stuck with this ONC situation and the federal government isn't going to reauthorize legislation that does this, what do we then as Oregon have to do if we think that your situation is untenable and we should do something different?
Chairman Barnhart and Representative Nos, I didn't see a ton of enthusiastic head nods when I suggested that the returning the $5 million general fund contribution to CAFA would be a good first step. So love to see some more head nods on that.
All of us have been told that the state is broke, and so we don't want to encourage you about something that may be a problem.
I realize that. I think the dynamic I saw during the recession, however, was, if you recall, Mr. Chair, Ways and Means Committee actually did provide level, if not increased, funding to the Department of Revenue during that period of time, recognizing that your tax collectors in that environment are sort of your most important asset. And that's exactly the same at the local level, is that, you know, Mike's shop is one of our most important assets. And I think to emphasize the point, we've got 80 plus taxing districts in Lane County. I don't know what the total number is in the four, but this gentleman provides services not just to the counties, but to all those taxing districts that really, really, even more so than the county, rely on those tax dollars. So the things that we can do to continue this kind of innovation. Jim mentioned that we did get some directed spending out of the legislature in 2014 for the project. The stage was set for that in 2013 with the passage of Senate Bill 173, which established an innovative service delivery project fund within the governor's office, precisely to sort of respond to counties that were willing to examine regional approaches to service delivery. That fund was established but not funded, and instead the co-chair said, if you have a good project, please come to us. We think this is a very interesting project that they thought so too and did provide the funding for it, but that fund, again, was not funded in the in this biennium. So it's a tool that's out there, but it does take, as you can tell, a lot of work to allow these counties to sort of work through politics, personalities, and you know, the bureaucracy of getting these things, everybody marching in the same direction. So it does take some incentive from outside.
Representative, did we get to your question?
Sorta.
Okay. All right. Representative, what's it?
Another thing that we have a problem with, certainly in our county, is we have over $100 million in road funds and SRSs that is sitting in an account earning 0.16% because our state treasurer will not allow it to be invested with the state pool. And we have a law on the books, and I'm hoping the new treasurer will allow this, because we could be earning about $4 million a year off from this money, and right now this is not happening with the present treasurer. For 2 years this bill has been in effect, and the counties are not being allowed to merge their funds in with the state funds to get a higher interest rate. So that's a huge amount of money that is sitting in some of these counties' road funds, which rightfully so, we're saving that money to take care of our roads, and we can't get a decent return of interest on that. And I know this really isn't what you're about, but there's a huge pot of money out there for some of these counties that we are not getting because we are not being allowed to do this, even though it's the law. So, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this presentation. I was interested in the part of your remarks that focused on the other counties not wanting to be involved because of the fear of further damaging small business. And we're all highly aware and sensitive to this now because of the discussion about the minimum wage increase and the damage that'll do to small business and the other burdens that are being placed upon small business in general. What I would be interested in is you guys' take on what it is that's fueling that reluctance. Is it is in those other counties? Because they must have had, as you mentioned, people in the room saying,
yes,
because don't come after us for this personal property tax. In my observation, personal property tax is pretty modest in many instances. Uh-huh. But this is a reflection of something, either because people just hate taxes, or is it because there's something more frightening, which is that the margins are so slim there that they don't want to put their small business further in jeopardy. And the question for you guys is, what's the percentage of small business out there in these counties that you're representing? Is it 10%? Is it 50%? In other words, I want a grasp of from you guys, because you're in a really good position to tell us right now, what kind of percentage of folks are going to be negatively impacted by this exercise you're engaging in, because you're best at that. But on the broader front, these other things we're discussing in this building that might in further challenge these small businesses.
Mm-hmm. I'll start and then Mike can do it. Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, to be more clear with you, the difficulty we had was primarily in Jackson and Josephine counties. And I think for those of you who have followed the media about the difficulties those two counties have had in dealing with their financial situation and federal timberlands and so forth, there are a number of people who come to their county commissioner meetings, who sit in the back of the room, who participate in the business from the audience, and who state their opinion very clearly as to what they think should happen in the county. It was just extremely difficult to get two of the three commissioners to agree to participate in this pilot project, given the audience participation that occurred in that particular day. So that's a little bit more background for you on what was going on. Mike may be able to share with you the of the businesses who have participated in our pilot, the new businesses that we found, how many of them are small, how many of them, or what was the average that they were paying?
Mr. Chair, or Representative Benz, sorry. As far as one of the first questions, I think a big piece is the misconception of the business personal property tax. As the chair noted, it's a very modest tax, and most businesses, their taxed amount are fairly close to the threshold for small businesses, which would equate to maybe $300-$400 in tax for their assets. I think a large part of the hesitancy from the businesses was some of them didn't have asset lists. A lot of businesses were not aware of their obligation to file business personal property taxes. Also, what I think really helped out was I spoke at several tax consultant, tax society meetings, people who do the accounting work for small businesses, and they were quite frankly just another more paperwork for them to fill out. And my answer to that was it may be a little bit of work up front the first time, but once you file, it's a pretty easy system to continue on, just to change the assets that have been reported or deleted. I think that was a big hesitancy. Again, also just the thought that businesses are already paying enough taxes was a comment that we heard a lot for small businesses, where Lane County has LTD and the Tri-Counties have Tri-County TriMet tax. A bit large comment was just, here's another tax we're going to have to pay. But in the obligation for me is to fairly assess property, and to fairly assess property is not to, is to make sure that one business is paying it, another business is similar size business is also paying those taxes. As to your question of a percentage, I think the percentage of businesses that we sent returns out to that fell under the threshold, usually it was about 80-90% usually fall under the threshold. So it's about 10-20% actually are above the threshold or at the threshold. So it's right around that range.
You can follow. So you're saying 80-90% of these businesses are so small they don't even have to pay the tax.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, that was indeed the question. so that we had a flavor for what type of business activity is actually happening in these smaller counties, mm-hmm. because you're in a great position to share with us the information you just gave. Right. And so that should make us all more sensitive to the impact that our decisions have out in those rural areas, like mine.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes. Representative Hale?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just chime in from my personal experience. I have, my law practice is small enough that it falls under the threshold. I'm assessed by the Washington County tax assessor for personal property. It couldn't be simpler. This is it's really of no consequence in terms of time management in my practice, and very easy. I think we one thing to remember is this isn't triggered by your revenue or by your gross income. It's triggered by your equipment, you know, what you have to run your business. And so those small businesses that are relatively simple are not burdened, I don't think, to a significant degree here.
Thank you, Mr. That's Chair. Advanced, right? We lawyers are seldom burdened by those kinds of things.
Mr. Chair.
Lawyers are used to filling out forms and writing stuff for other people. They can do it for themselves, too. Please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, to your point, I did hear Lincoln Cannon yesterday in the House Committee on Rural Communities, and he talked about the number of mills that have been reduced in the state of Oregon in even the last decade by three quarters. So, I mean, I think these in rural Oregon, those were many of our larger employers were those kinds of facilities, and they've all but disappeared from the landscape. Again, Representative Noe's trying back to that federal forest policy, which has just been hammered a number of mills that were just unable to get federal logs.
Yeah. Yes. I think it might be useful for I'm counting, and I think there are at least five members of the committee who are probably not familiar with CAFA. So I don't know that we're going to do it today because we're out of time, but I think it would be useful for LRO to refer members to something they can read quickly about how CAFA works that would be useful. I want to bring us back to the initial topic. It appears that the bet that the Ways and Means Committee made by providing these dollars for this project were very well spent. They are going to produce substantially more dollars than the cost of the project, just in the counties that are using it now. And of course, if you do a good best practices report and distribute it to the other counties in the state, and not just the ones that not just the seven, but everybody else, we may end up with an even better result over the long haul. I am acutely aware, as we talk about compliance issues on all of our taxes, that if we pay attention carefully to the details, to these small items in terms of overall dollars, we improve voluntary compliance across the board for everything. That's why the information that we got earlier today about unpaid debt, and the care that the Department of Revenue is working on in that area, what you've put in on this little piece, all of these things are critically important to maintaining a tax system where Oregonians and Americans voluntarily file a tax return and pay their taxes. If we look at other countries where the custom is to avoid paying taxes, to not pay them, and you mentioned Greece, and that's exactly the one I was thinking of, you see how these kind of customary things arise over time if the government isn't paying attention, and including in the culture, the idea, here it is, it's March, it's time to file that return. Here it is, it's April, it's time to file that other return. That's what we do. That's what part of being a good citizen is. If being a good citizen means figuring out how to dodge the tax man, as it is in other countries, it has huge impacts, negative impacts on the entire economy, which is why countries like Greece are in huge trouble these days and why people are out of work there. So while it may be easy for us to think this is a small thing, and it is, doing it keeps it a small thing. And I have to say that I personally appreciate the care and the work I look forward to reading that final report you're going to send to all the other counties on how to do it, because I think that's the kind of thing that that is really beneficial. And the Ways and Means Committee and the legislature will have spent those dollars very well, with a great rate of return, not just with the dollars that come in, but with the whole system of voluntary compliance that we need to maintain. Really important. Thank you very much. OLCC, and we're a couple minutes late because Barnhart talked too long. Mazin.
Mr. Chair, committee members, during the interim and also during the regular session, several of the members had a few questions about the way we regulate and treat the taxation of the different product that the Oregon Liquor Control Commission does, such as beer, and how is it different from wine and liquor, and then finally the way the commission is dealing and coping with the new product that we gave them to regulate. So we asked the commission to come and present to you today. We have it on their presentation on all us. Today we have the commission chair, Rob Partridge, and the executive director, Steve Marks, and also their economist and financial director, I guess, Mr. Bill Schuette, to present to you about these issues and talk to you in general about these different issues and regulation functions that they perform for the state.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming today. We appreciate it.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rob Partridge. I'm the chair of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I'm happy to be here today to give you kind of an overview of where we're going and what's going on. We certainly were in front of the Marijuana Committee yesterday, and so it is a dynamic, changing, and interesting time at the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, not only in the marijuana field, but also we've done a lot of different things related to alcohol, how that will ultimately impact the state's revenue over the course of the near term. So we have a lot of really exciting things to talk about and tell you today. I'm going to dive into some of those things a little bit later as to some of the future stuff. I'm going to turn it over to Director Marks at this point in time to move forward on part of the PowerPoint. We'll kind of rotate it around a little bit.
For the record, Steve Marks, Executive Director of OLCC. I'm going to give you a brief overview of our alcohol program and marijuana program, take a look at some of the legislative directives you've provided us in the budget and how we're going to move forward on those. With the alcohol program, the OLCC oversees the distribution and sale of distilled spirits in the state of Oregon. We centrally purchase, warehouse, and distribute distilled spirits throughout the state through our independent contracted agent structure. We license and regulate businesses that serve alcohol, our bars and our restaurants that sell alcohol to go, our grocery stores and convenience stores, and then manufacture and wholesale alcohol, breweries, wineries, distilleries, and distributors. And the recreational marijuana program, we're responsible for implementation of Measure 91, House Bill 3400. We will license and regulate growers, processors, wholesalers, retailers, laboratories, provide research certificates, and marijuana handler permits. We'll also track the growing, transportation, processing, and selling of recreational marijuana products through our cannabis tracking system. A little more depth on alcohol programs. We license the businesses that sell alcohol. We issue server permits to trained alcohol servers. We manage and distribute the distilled spirits. We regulate the businesses that serve and sell alcohol and enforce our standards. We provide public information about the responsible use of alcohol. course, generate revenue for essential services, both at state and county, like police and education and health care. We administer a hearings unit. We provide for the siting of redemption centers through the Oregon Bottle Bill. And we establish our annual, we provide an annual liquor agent training program. Legislature gave us a lot of work to do in terms of capital investment and the retail and alcohol side of the program. You provided $5 million for us to increase our shipping capacity in our warehouse. I think it was last September prior to the session we came in and we're talking about the potential that we would reach maximum capacity there, and it was up to a $70 million threat to revenues. I noticed in the paper today we went up to 4 million in population in Oregon, so this will help us continue to serve Oregonians through our warehouse. You provided $4.2 million for roof repairs to stop our leaking roofs. This is the first of a multi-year installment. We thank you very much for that. We're in the process of implementation there. Provided funds for our upgrade in our phone system. Moving forward with that, for the first time, because of prior legislative requirements, we have budgeted for DPSST training of our peace officers. We're moving forward with training programs for both alcohol and marijuana peace officer functions. You also invested in our agent structure and provided over $612,000 in increased compensation, because our formula for agent compensation used to penalize agents that made an investment when they moved from exclusive liquor sales selling only distilled spirits to non-exclusive where they sold beer and wine. So this removes the penalty that they had in our compensation because of that funding. And then we are implementing a non-refundable application fee not to exceed $150, which was provided for by law. I'll turn it back over to Rob.
So alcohol certainly is, and specifically distilled spirits, are the engine that helps fuel the legislative revenue here in the state of Oregon. We have 248 retail liquor locations around the state of Oregon. You can see those dotted around the state, as well as 152 standalone stores of that 248, 96 co-located with grocery or general goods, and then not shown on that map is the 87 retail outlets which only sell their own products, and mainly those are down the I-5 corridor. The next slide shows what we're up to in terms of expansion. The OLCC is in the midst of doing the largest retail expansion since Prohibition on a single rollout. That's 17 stores in the Portland area market, in that tri-county market that we're looking at. We're looking at those to meet customer convenience and some density things. We're doing it a lot different than the OLCC has done store location before. Typically what OLCC has done in store location has done one or two stores. They've picked a location, they've advertised for a single location, and then had applicants come in and apply. What the OLCC has done at this point in time is we've said that we're interested in expanding up to 17 stores in the Tri-County market, which is about a 23% expansion, I believe, in that Tri-County area. We've done that based upon a lot of the statistics that are listed below that. But what we've done now is we've allowed people to apply for one or multiple stores. We've allowed existing agents to continue to apply as well. We've had two kind of open sessions that people came to the OLCC who had an interest in being liquor agents. We had over 100 people attend those two informational sessions that we held at OLCC. We've also gone out into the community through chambers of commerce, through minority business groups, and other entrepreneurial groups that are people seeking business opportunities, and we've gone out and done speeches and provided information through their mailing lists and everything else to try and network in those communities as well. So we've really tried to.
Excuse me, Representative Smith Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, and thank you for this information.
Yes.
May I assume, because I don't have a calculator here, that 17, with that added on, the goal is to bring the metro area to the same or much closer to the same as the statewide, because that's kind of seen as the ideal? Was it that kind of strategic,
how'd you pick that number? I'll let Bill and Steve speak to that a little bit specifically.
So
related
it's not
to
a
that.
Short answer.
For the
percentages.
Percentage-wise, the OLCC hasn't picked a particular percentage that this is our optimal goal related to population density, because it's very, very different in different parts of the state. And so we've selected that market to be competitive with what we saw in other control states and other as we've looked across the United States in control states and non-control states.
Okay. That's a sufficient answer.
Before they answer, I would simply note there's a big difference between a store in downtown Eugene with a very substantial population density around it, mm-hmm. and the liquor store in the back of a more general store in Sisters or in Brownsville, where the population is much smaller. And so if you were using that as the average, it would probably be more like 7,000 or 8,000, or maybe less even in those areas.
Right.
So you could have a much higher density in the highly urbanized parts of the state and still have sufficient coverage, whereas if you have to drive 200 miles to get to a liquor store, that's an imposition in eastern Oregon, even if the population is small.
Right. Also has to do with the demographics of the population that's consuming alcohol as well. So there's a lot of factors that go into. We're not just a state agency. We have to look at the market certainly for what goes on.
Yeah, Representative Whitsitt.
I was wondering if you worry at all about owner monopolies developing when you say that you are not restricting the ownership to new, to just new owners who are coming in for these. I mean, are you looking at the possibility of individuals controlling multiple sites within certain regions?
Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsitt, we do have that in today's market. The commission is very cognizant of trying not to create monopolies and trying to create competition, and we have some things in our rules that would allow us not to make that happen, but we are certainly interested in. There's certainly some interest in people owning multiple stores. We've liberalized some of those things because of the applicant pool, frankly, that's been available out there. So at some point in time, you reach some type of critical mass as well to provide those ancillary services that go along with running a liquor store as well. This is a new project. It's a new way to look at expansion. If this expansion goes well in the Portland market, the commission is interested in looking at doing some of these innovative things in other parts of the state. We feel like it puts puts a lot more of the onus into the market, makes it a more market-driven model, and also puts a lot of the onus on the entrepreneurs in terms of what's going on. So we're very interested in trying to deal with that. I would point out to the committee, since we're here today in front of you, that there is a ballot measure where they're gathering signatures. I would tell you, as the chair, I am somewhat concerned that could chill the effect of people stepping forward at this point in time to invest their capital on something that could potentially be on the November ballot. And them not knowing the uncertainty. So it certainly creates some uncertainty in the market, but the proponents of that measure have said for many years now they were going to put something on the ballot. Nothing's been on the ballot, and at some point in time the OLCC has a responsibility to the citizenry to look at what the optimization pieces are. So we're continuing to move forward, but we could make some different decisions based upon the qualifications of the applicant pool that are going to step forward and apply to invest their capital. So that's but we're very excited. I think we've gotten some nice interest, and we've done a lot more outreach into non-traditional communities than we have, and we're hoping to see some diversity as well. I turn it over to Bill Schutte for money, the money part of it.
For the record, Bill Schutte, economist with the Liquor Control Commission. I'm going to go through a brief overview of the gross revenue sources that we generate, excluding marijuana until the very end, and I'll talk about the marijuana revenues and how that's changed with several pieces of legislation that occurred last session. On this first slide, you'll see that, of course, the great bulk of our distilled spirits or revenue comes from distilled spirits. I just noticed a typo. It should be $1.13 billion instead of $1.15, but it is 96% of the gross revenue that we do process in any given year. With full disclosure, that is the gross revenue, so about half of that $1.15 billion is a manufactured cost, which has to be paid back to people like Diageo and those companies, but it is a significant part of what we do out there. And then rounding it up, we do also collect beer and wine tax fees, almost $37 million projected in this current biennium. And then we have about $12 million for license fees and fines, and then a miscellaneous income of about $731,000. So always of interest to the revenue we generate is our forecast. So we forecast in biennium, but also 10-year increments. Here's the historical gross liquor sales over since 1970s. Currently about we booked $1.06 billion for the 13-15 biennium. We're looking at $1.13 billion for 15-17. Through the first 4 months of this biennium, we're tracking about 1% over that forecast, but we are still pretty early in the forecast. It is difficult to track.
Just a moment. Representative Nelson, please. Yeah.
Oh, thanks. I was just curious what that's a very the growth rate is very, I don't know, steep, at least that's the way it looks on my screen. Okay. Is that just based on population, or is it population and consumers are using more of the product, or
Chair, Representative, there's a number of reasons for that. Most of it is population driven, but there is been a switch or a change from especially malt beverage to beer and wine. So there's been an increase in spirits consumption and wine consumption over the, especially the last 10 years. And I'll show a slide on how that's changed as well coming forward. On average, over the last 20 years, this revenue source has grown at about 5.6%. That's about twice the rate of inflation. And we foresee a slightly lower growth over the next 10 years, about forecasting 4.5%. But that's probably more the conservative nature of trying to get our forecast right rather than exceeding revenue expectations. But it is a pretty stable source of revenue as well, as you can tell. This is our classic bottle of our distilled spirits model. Average bottle price last year was $16.50. And you can see starting from the bottom that about 50% of that was the manufacturer cost, as I alluded to before. We have the next layer, about almost 9% for the liquor store operator commission. That would be the retail markup. A small sliver in there of 1% for bank card cost. We do pick up the credit card cost for all purchases within the state. And then 4%, the orange, lighter orange, which is all of OLCC operating expenses, including enforcement, licensing, administration, and distribution functions. And then the net profit to the state is 37%, and it goes to cities, counties, and the general fund.
Mm-hmm. Representative Vance, please.
So I have to ask why the use of the term profit?
Chair, Representative, we work on a totally markup system. It's been alluded to as a tax. We don't have a specific liquor tax in the state of Oregon. We operate this warehouse as a business. And the profit is, again, determined by the legislature and the commission, and is just something that we, you know, make as operating it as a business.
Thank you.
So a little bit about the contribution, especially of Oregon distilleries, to the economy of Oregon. There are currently 77 distilleries in Oregon. that have 87 distillery locations, as Chair Patridge referenced later. So there are, these distilleries can sell product at multiple locations besides their own. Example is there's one kiosk in a Portland airport that can sell Oregon products. These represent about $69 million in fiscal year 2015, or 13% of the total liquor sales within the state. $5.6 million of this came from the actual distillery locations themselves. And a word about the 50-cent surcharge. Back in 2009, as the economy was starting to soften, we saw liquor sales start to soften as well, and so the commission instituted a 50-cent surcharge to generate additional revenue. The current 50-cent surcharge has been extended through by the commission through June 30th of 2017. It is extended by commission action, but is always anticipated in our biennial budgets. And this current biennium is expected to generate almost $34 million. The current distribution of the revenue is determined by the legislature, but for the most part goes to the general fund and is destined for the general fund during this session. A little bit about beer and wine tax.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What, and the original genesis of the 50-cent surcharge?
During 2009, as Representative Chair, as we were coming out of the recession, there was a softening in liquor sales, and there was fear that we weren't going to be meeting our revenue projections, especially our distribution to the general fund. During the middle of that biennium, August of 2009, the commission implemented a 50-cent a bottle surcharge, which added 50 cents to the cost of each bottle, and that generated approximately, you know, revenue that would got us back up to the original projection for the general fund. The commission has renewed that surcharge every year since 2009 and has been renewed through 2017.
And the follow-up, of course, is obvious, but why? What's the justification now if you're meeting your goal, our goal?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, that's a very good question. The commission continues to renew the surcharge and has continued to be considered in our biennial budget.
And I'm sure the Ways and Means Committee appreciates it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bentz, during not this last legislative session, but the session before that, the legislature also asked the commission to raise an additional 25-cent tax, which the commission rejected. So the commission has decided on an ongoing basis to maintain the 50 cents, but we do have marginally one of the highest liquor taxes for distilled spirits in the country. We have the second highest tax in the country next to the state of Washington.
Yes, please.
Right. Of course, the we don't use that term tax as profit, but the question would be what keeps us honest? Why not a dollar? Why not $5? What market force prevents us from raising that 50 cents or maybe reconsidering the 50 cents?
I think that
ballot measure that's out there, is that what's going on?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bentz, I think it's a decision that the commission makes upon what its own costs are related to what the surcharge adds per bottle. We can make that decision whether we're going to take that out of the whether the legislature funds that out of the general fund, or we can continue to help fund that out of a surcharge. It certainly is a policy decision that can be made one way or the other. The legislature also has the ability to change the markup as well. So it is a dynamic that was set up long before any of us were here, and it is the waltz between the legislative revenue committee and the rest of the legislature, as well as the commission's ability to raise a surcharge one way or the other. The commission felt like the surcharge was during the last ask for a raise of 25 cents. We felt that it was too much, so the commissioners chose not to go down that path. But we did report back to the legislature that we, for revenue stability for the state, that we were going to continue that 50-cent tax. It was assumed in the governor's budget as well. So it is a dynamic that sometimes may not be as rational as we would like it to be.
Yes, Representative, what's it?
So is that, what was your average bottle, $8 and something?
We got $16,
six.
Yeah.
How much?
$16 a bottle.
16, yeah. So 50 cents.
50 cents of that.
Yeah. You might should put that up on when you do your, it's not on your bottle, right, as is, does it show up in, you know, the bottle?
It does show up in the top part of the, excuse me, Mr. Chair and Representative Woodson, it does show up in the top part of the bottle as we've just lumped in only the surcharge, but the, but the markup.
Okay.
So it's included in that figure,
yeah, 37%,
I believe, in
yes.
the 37%. We could certainly break it out. We could break it out differently. But.
Yeah, Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you all for your presentation. We're talking about the 50-cent surcharge, but more generally, what factors does the Commission consider in setting prices at the retail level?
I'm going to let Bill talk to you because it's formulaic.
Yeah.
So,
Chair, Representative Davis, we have a formulaic approach to setting prices. We, the Commission itself, determines the markup. Markup is approximately 105%, but the formula is a bit more convoluted than that. So the manufacturers will come in and determine what their retail price will be, run it through our formula, and then the outcome, which includes also adding on a 50-cent surcharge. The formula is something the Commission hasn't changed for a while, but it has been stable and continues to be used by manufacturers that establish their prices.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
And thank you. Is the formula based on market condition? I mean, what is the form? What does that mean, the formula?
Chair, Representative Davis, the formula is a combination of a base cost to move the product through the warehouse, a general markup formula, the addition of the 50 cents. I can provide the exact formula to you if you want to see that and the impacts, but it is also meant to provide a higher markup for lower cost liquor and a slightly lower markup for higher cost liquor. So in the public consumption area, it is to incentivize, you know, lower consumption for the lower cost liquor and, you know, move people to buy in the higher, better stuff.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it is market driven because the manufacturers basically are setting their wholesale prices and then that translates into the formula. So manufacturers are coming forward with what they would like pricing to be, which is what, you know, it's just a matter of which lever you're pulling on to get it done.
Just to follow up on that, is all of your markup based on a certain number of cents per bottle, or is it partly based on the price or the cost of the particular product? I understand that the 50 cents is per each bottle or per each three-quarters of a liter, I suppose. I don't know how you do that.
Yeah.
But is the rest of the formula based on a per bottle, or is it based partly on the cost of the product?
Chair Barnhart, again, a somewhat convoluted formula, and I can provide more detail on that. But basically, the formula is based on a case of product coming in, the cost of that case. Sometimes the case has six bottles, sometimes the case has 12 bottles, depending on the size of it. So then we apply it per bottle and then mark it up per transportation, handling cost, and then add the 50 cent per bottle surcharge on top of it. So it's really based on the case as it comes into the warehouse.
Okay. Now, is any of it based on the cost that you pay for that case?
Yes.
Okay. That was the thing that hasn't been said yet, and I wanted to be clear about it. At least part of the markup is based on what that liquor costs you.
Right. So that
and part of it is that 50 cents per bottle markup.
So that 49% is the manufacturer's cost that we have to pay to the manufacturers to get back, and then it's marked up from there based on the cost of that, the number of bottles, and the 50 cents.
Now we'll get back to Representative Whitsitt. Thank you.
Thank you. So I have a question about, we're surrounded by other states, and down in my part of the state, you drive 12 miles over into California and you buy your alcohol much cheaper. So does that happen in Idaho and Washington? How much are you losing? Obviously, Klamath doesn't matter, but Portland, how is Washington compare to Oregon in particular?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, very good question. Again, a very complicated question. We have not done any exclusive documentation on the any losses on the southern Oregon border to California. It's a system that's been in place for a long time. However, we can say that after Washington privatized, the prices went up there approximately between 25% and 30%, and we've seen a tremendous increase, softened a little bit, but still on our border stores on the Washington border, about a 25% to 30% increase in sales overall. With respect to Idaho, Idaho has a very similar system to Oregon's. Similar type of markup. We can gauge their prices. On average, Idaho prices are about 5% cheaper than Oregon's, but we don't notice a lot of border traffic on that area. But on the other hand, Idaho has also benefited greatly from the transition up in Washington as well.
And Mr. Chair, and for the record, the California issue is their taxes marginally a lot lower than our taxes. Okay. And so, you know, that I think that that makes a huge difference as somebody who
lives down there.
All right. And we interrupted. Why don't you go ahead with wherever it was you left off?
All right.
10 minutes ago.
I'll move on to beer and wine then. The red line shows the malt beverage tax collected since 1979. You can see the wine tax has crossed over in about 2003 and now is a higher proportion of that revenue. We collect $37 million annually between beer and wine. That has increased an average of about 2.5% per year over the last 20 years. And of note, especially this committee, and they always seem to take a run of it every session, but the beer tax is currently at about 8 cents per gallon, and the wine tax is 67 cents per gallon for table wine, and has been that way since 1977.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Good question. What do we think, what was the dip in 2010 or 2011 with regard to, looks like, beer taxes?
Chair, Representative, this is part of the trend that we're looking at, especially with malt beverage, and we're not talking, and I'll talk a little bit about Oregon microbrews, but malt beverage in general has seen a leveling off in sales over the last 10 years. Mostly through the large producers such as Budweiser and Coors, and that's been reflected really in the trend itself in leveling revenue. In malt beverage itself, that you can see that it is a little more volatile. There was a big dip in 2011 that was a tax case that had to be resolved, so we had to return some money to a major distributor, and then it's come back up a little bit since then, but been fairly flat over the last 10 years.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And a little bit off topic, but a little bit about Oregon malt beverage production. Last year, we did some series of presentations for a legislative task force looking at the economic impact of Oregon craft industries. And so we dug a little bit more into the tax records. This is from 2013. But from those records, we found that there were 43 million gallons produced from Oregon brewers. About 16 million of those, or 19% of Oregon's total beer consumption, came from Oregon craft brewers, but more importantly, most importantly from an economic driver standpoint, almost 27 million gallons were exported outside the state. So the craft beverage industry, malt beverage industry, is significant to economics, not just in Oregon, but especially rural areas we're finding too.
Yes, Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you. Do you know what the annual gross revenue from the Oregon malt beverage production sector is?
Chair, Representative Leininger, we don't have the total gross production. We'd have the total amount of tax that's collected because all the tax collected is collected from our distributors and our brewage, but we could make an estimate on that, but we don't have what the gross revenue is for that.
Yes.
We just have the gallons that are being reported to places like TTB.
So 6%, or it's a 6% tax, is that? Oh, no, it's a 6-cent tax.
8 cents a gallon tax, yeah.
8 cents a gallon. It would be interesting to get the export numbers for Oregon distillers as well yes. Another time.
Yeah. And finally, the final source of our revenue are the liquor license fees. averaging about 5% growth over the last 20 years, approximately $12 million of the 15-17 budget. Again, similar to beer and wine, these fees are in statute. An off-premise license fee, basically grocery convenience store, is $100 annually. An on-premise license fee is $400, which is a full-service bar. Again, these are some of the lowest in the country, but again, they are in statute. So this is something that we continue to enforce as well.
And it would be useful to know how close those are to paying your costs for the administration and enforcement on those, and not, again, not today.
Yeah, well, Chair Barnhart, we have done those calculations. They cover between 25% and 30% of the cost of our enforcement administration.
Thank you. Representative Leininger.
Thank you so much. Thank you for this great information and your great work over the last year on the marijuana issues. It's really been a pleasure to work with your team. I am asking the chair, but maybe you folks, whatever the chair deems appropriate, would it be possible to get a one-pager that depicts the annual gross revenue from the Oregon beer industry, the Oregon-produced wine industry, and the Oregon and the distilled spirits industry, and then the cannabis, legal and illegal? I just know that I was struck by the fact that some people have indicated to the Marijuana Legalization Committee that when you aggregate illegal and illegal production in Oregon, the annual market value is estimated to be $1 billion, which is, you know, it's extraordinary. And I'm wondering how that compares to some of the other regulated recreational products that Oregon produces.
That's something that LRO probably could do. Of course, I'm getting a head nod over there.
It's a double head nod, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I think it's useful to have that kind of data at your fingertips. And, yeah.
And Chair and Representative, we have attempted to do those sorts of estimations in the past, and we will work with legislative revenue on that and sharing that sort of information. But again, especially the gross receipts from beer is not something we track specifically. We track the number of gallons sold in the state and the tax sold in the state, but you know, we can make some at least educated guesses perhaps from the gallons that are being consumed.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Leininger, we've done several attempts on different levels of different things in the past. We'll be able to probably compile some of these. Not all the answers are readily available, as you would probably know, but at least we have some educated guesses on how things might react from a market point of view, and why is Washington works that way with Oregon, and you know, we call it the Oregon-Washington dance kind of thing, because they do influence our taxes, volumes, and exports and imports. They have the same level of industries, but different taxation systems and so on.
And then our final slide here is the actual biennial distribution. We've booked $436 million. To cities, counties, and the general fund in 13-15. That's expected to be $470 million during the 15-17 biennium. We are, as best of our estimation, on track to meet that amount. That has, again, risen at an average annual rate of about 5.5% over the last 20 years, or about twice the rate of inflation. And this shows where that money goes to, about half of it to the general fund, city revenue sharing, incorporated cities, mental health, $589,000. That's really the 2 cents out of the 67 cents that goes for wine tax to the wine board itself, and then $39 million to the counties. And this formula is in statute as well. So we'll switch gears a little bit here and talk about marijuana tax collection and some of the changes that we've had since the last time we presented before this committee. I'll talk specifically about the two big legislative changes. House Bill 2041 moved tax collection from the OLCC to the Department of Revenue. It also moved the tax collection point from the grower level, or dollars per ounce level to a point of sale. So the current 2041 established a 17% tax on the value of product at retail with an optional 3% optional local tax. Part of 2441 is OLCC will support Department of Revenue and tax collection. It was alluded to before, our cannabis tracking system, also sometimes known as seed-to-sale system, will be used to support Department of Revenue as far as verifying tax amounts, audits, any other thing that they need. Second big piece of legislation was House Bill 3400, where OLCC will license and regulate recreational marijuana, but the big change here was it established a fee-based regulation system. So OLCC is to set fees by rule, and we've just done that, and I'll show you those fees that cover the program cost. So a little bit about 15-17 marijuana revenue. Legislature approved for us $8.3 million for program implementation. We are currently borrowing from the Liquor Fund to finance this startup, new positions, information technology, and other startup costs. That borrowing will be repaid eventually at 2% interest. Startup costs during the 15-17 biennium will be covered by a combination of both license fees as we start our licensing after January of 2016 and tax revenue during the current biennium. As I said, includes repayment. But the directive is marijuana will be completely fee-funded by the 17-19 biennium. So we will have to set fees that will cover the cost of administering that program. So the big question is, how do you do that when we don't know how many licensees will be in the state? We don't know what the administration costs for the number of licenses. So we had to take a white wag at it. And this was part of our rulemaking process. We estimate that in 17-19, at the current service level, we'll look about $7.9 million. And then we also took a wag at estimating the number of licenses for marijuana that we expect to see established in the state based on specific categories for Colorado and Washington through their first years of implementation, and then came up with an average of about 826 total licenses for the state of Oregon, which was kind of a combination of looking at both Washington and Colorado. There are some differences between the states, but there's mostly some similarities. Washington specifically has capped the number of retail outlets, so we had to account for that. We did adjust our own Oregon estimate up for retail outlets because they would have been proportionally quite a bit lower than Washington and Colorado. But we did adjust them up current for the number of medical dispensaries that are currently in place and expect to, based on an OHA survey, that could transition to recreational licenses. So on October 22nd, OLCC Commission adopted license fees. These are in temporary rule. Average license fee is $4,750. With a $250 application fee, so a licensee getting the system will have to pay about $5,000 the first go around. We will look at this on an annual basis and look at our own program cost, adjust it for the number of licensees we actually have to regulate, and move forward as far as adjusting these fees as needed, and being able to look at them as relative to their own program cost. And I guess with that, we'll conclude for any questions.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Representative Leininger, please.
I don't know if you have the information with you, but if you could state for us the annual revenue that Colorado and Washington have received from their programs, it might be interesting for people to get a sense of the quantum of tax revenue those programs generate.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Leininger, I don't have those numbers with me here, but we do have them on file. But keep in mind that with the tax rates, both Washington and Colorado have very different tax rates than Oregon does. And in fact, they have higher tax rates, but we can get you that information.
Great. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. An issue that's been brought up to me recently is regarding the siting of retail establishments. Apparently the law as it's passed calls out buffers from educational facilities, Okay. But the law is pretty only appears to cover K-12 facilities. It's silent about post-secondary, i.e. colleges and universities. Is this an issue that you all have heard about? Do you have a plan to try to amend that, or would you like some legislative help in making that amendment happen?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, it's a legislative statute. We have heard from a few people related to that particular issue, and it certainly would be something that should the legislature give us direction on that, we would certainly be willing to work with them on what those issues are. But the time, place, and manner regulations certainly are a hotbed of activity.
Okay, good. Follow up. Could I go back and talk about alcohol for a minute? And back, I think, to your original slide, which talks about one of the responsibilities for OLCC is the bottle bill regulation, and specifically the build out of the redemption centers. When we passed the expansion of the redeemable containers back in 2012-13, you know, we were promised that there would be a statewide network in place, and I think it's the number that's required is somewhere in the 40s, 42, 45 redemption centers statewide to cover the state, so that when, again, the redemption value on every container virtually happens, there'll be a place for consumers to conveniently take those and get the redemption back. That happens in 2018, I believe. 2017, we're on track to double the redemption value from 5 cents to 10 cents. And it's my opinion, and it's the opinion that I continually get from my local retailers, grocery stores, that we're on track for a train wreck. Because when we have people paying a significant portion of their grocery bills in deposits, and yet when they go to redeem those deposits, they're going to run into chaos at the local level, because primarily you still have grocery stores with these machines that are not reliable, not the most desirable place to stand in line to get your money back. So what's the roadblock? Where are we currently now on that? What are roadblocks, I guess? What are the deterrents from having that statewide system in place that we were promised, 4 years ago?
If the answer is more than about two sentences, I think we really need to get it on another day. This is a big topic.
It's a very big topic.
And I think it's a very important topic to discuss. I'm not sure that it makes, that it,
I'd be happy
it does
it
justice
offline.
To it to try to do it today. Unless you want to give a couple of comments now.
Chairman Barnhart, Representative Johnson, our role is really limited, right? When the nonprofit forms it and they get the grocers to go in and say they have an agreement, then we look at that agreement. And that's really our only role, is to provide for the approval once they have those agreements in place. We have worked to encourage them when there have been non-members within an area that have been reticent to come into agreement at times, but it's been a pretty limited role on our part.
So it'd be OBRC would be the
yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. That's helpful. One area we have not talked about today, and I think it would be we'd be remiss if we didn't at least mention it, was the OLCC's responsibility for controlling the distribution of alcoholic beverages to minors, or I guess I should say preventing it. And I know that that behind all of these marketing issues that you've talked about today, and mostly in response to our questions, that one of the considerations you always have, I assume, mm-hmm. is the likelihood of a shift in the access of alcohol by minors. Do you want to comment on that issue for a couple of sentences?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we do have a very large focus on making sure that alcohol doesn't get into the hands of minors. We run minor sting operations throughout the state of Oregon, as well as participate in a variety of ways and forums. But we still have about a 20% of the people are not checking the IDs adequately, and it is getting into the hands of minors. So we are concerned about that, not only on the alcohol side, but we continue to be concerned about that as we move into a marijuana setting as well, that we have the adequate staffing to be able to do that on an ongoing basis. And what I would tell you, too, is we, as the commission, I think that I have some concerns about how the law enforcement side of things or the regulatory side of things are funded when it's only fee-based, because it puts us in a bad situation. If everything is fee-based related to the enforcement piece, it puts us in a direct conflict with the people we're regulating as well, whereas on the alcohol side, we pull from the general fund. So it's a very interesting dynamic. It is a large public policy issue that I think ultimately this legislature down the line is going to be asked to address, because the fees are substantially higher than what the marijuana community considered. And as we ramp up to make sure that public safety is the important is a very important and equal component of this, whether we're going to be able to continue to raise fees and be in conflict with industry. So we want to make sure and do that. And I think we also, I think the commission is looking for clarity from the legislature as well, not only on the alcohol side. We kind of dip our toe into the kind of prevention efforts and run some grants occasionally and those things. But I would tell you that Director Marks, prior to his previous job, and myself and others, some of the alcohol and prevention money is kind of spread throughout a variety of state agencies, and it's not clear who's going to do anything related to marijuana, related to public awareness. And so I think that that is, as you look to the future of that public safety component, we certainly at OLCC are willing to embrace those directions, but we may not be the right place for that, and OHA may be the right place for that. We're not lobbying for anything, but we recognize that. That's why we stepped up on the marijuana piece to come to the legislature, where we were able to at least fund what's legal Oregon, so we could have some public awareness about what the legalities of the new marijuana measure were.
Representative Leininger.
Thank you. And I want to really credit OLCC for your attention to youth prevention efforts, and Chair Patridge has a really good idea that he is working on rolling out. But I think one of the things you may see from the Marijuana Legalization Committee in a bill this coming short session is a proposal to require additional youth prevention education outreach. And to explicitly draw OLCC into it, because they have done a great job with their Educate Before You Recreate campaign, but though the legislature in the long session required OHA and the Department of Education to get together on a prevention curriculum, OLCC isn't expressly brought in, and there's no express delineation of funding source to fund the education campaign. So if we really are serious about this, we're going to be called on to take some action in this coming session.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I just wanted to add that in licensing compliance in our section, we are integrating both alcohol and marijuana enforcement programs together. So we're leveraging our management structure and staff structure around alcohol to bring in this new marijuana enforcement staff. And I think you saw a lot on our chart about capital investments we asked for in the last budget. I think when we come back, we're going to be asking for the people resources to make those programs work in the next budget here.
Thank you. You indicated difficulties with clerks identifying buyers, customers. Is that more likely to occur in your licensed liquor stores, or is it more likely to occur in retail shops that sell beer and wine?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it occurs more at the retail level with beer and wine. It does not occur as often, because we have such a large stick with the liquor agents in and of themselves.
And if a measure like the one that you mentioned in your opening were to be approved, and liquor were to be distributed in Oregon through the same kinds of mechanisms we now distribute beer and wine, my inference, at least from what you just said, is that our enforcement difficulties would increase. Do you think that's true, or am I making up something here?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think that that is a very reasonable inference to make, that there certainly could be some potential more problems related to access by minors.
Thank you. Anything else for this panel? I want to say thank you very much for a thorough presentation today. We interrupted you a number of times. You got back on your thread anyway. I want to say the OLCC provides a very important source of revenue for the general fund, for cities and counties and others. From my point of view, it's important to maintain that. We need to figure out how we're going to do that, regardless of of the political activities on the ballot, and the enforcement functions that OLCC has are really, really important. Well, this is not the Health Committee. Members of this committee are very familiar with the realities of brain maturation and development, and the realities that if children are able to get a hold of a large number of different substances, addiction follows. Addiction to the kinds of things that you regulate is no fun at all for anybody. Appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Paul, we're short on time. Do you want to start with this next presentation?
Mr. Chair, I recommend that we do. Kyle has been updating this, and we did put him off in September too. So
okay,
he's been chomping at the bit ever since then. But this is the looking at the a project that we've talked with you about, an interim project that Kyle's heading up on the property taxation of nonprofits. So this is by way of an update of where he is, a background, and then we'll be shooting for looking at something more substantive for the 17 session.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office, for the record. And yeah, as Paul was just describing, I'm just going to briefly go through an interim project that we're working on that will be delivered prior to the 2017 long session. And I'm going to be working off of there. I do have about 7 or 8 slides in the meeting materials. It should be the last thing in the meeting materials, an OLIS titled Property Taxation and Exemption of Nonprofits. And I do have a couple tables up there that are smaller fonts, so it might be easier to see on your PCs than up on the screen. But what I want to do today is just to briefly go over what it is, the project that we're working on, what we think the end result will be, some of the deliverables, the scope of the study, and then I'll also briefly touch on, especially in the interest of time, a little bit of background on the statute we're intending to focus on, and then also talk about what's being done in other states at a very high level. But the project that we're working on is kind of a discussion of the taxation and exemption of nonprofits, and this is from the property tax revenue stream only. And the scope of the study, right now, I know there's a work group that is probably going to inform some of the study, so this is the information we have, or the idea we have going forward right now, but it's certainly subject to change as we get legislative input. But the scope of the study right now that we've seen it is to briefly touch on all the different property tax exemptions related to nonprofits in more just a description of the different exemptions that are available, but to narrow down on one specific exemption provided by ORS 307-130, which is the literary, charitable, and scientific organizations exemption. That's typically how it's referred to. I do have a list, and this is what I was mentioning earlier. It's a pretty small font, but this is the list of all the nonprofit property tax exemptions that are on the books today, and these are exemptions specific to nonprofits. Of course, there are other exemptions that nonprofits could avail themselves to, but these are ones specific for nonprofits. And I've ordered this table from the highest estimated revenue loss on down. And I have in here, I have the tax expenditure number, that's the TE number. So this links up with the governor's tax expenditure report, so you can cross-reference there if you'd like more background information. But I have the tax expenditure number, the statute that provides the exemption, and then the statute name and the estimated revenue loss that was contained in the most recent tax expenditure report released as a companion document to the governor's recommended budget. So you can see, just looking at this list, the top on the list right there is the 307-130 literary, benevolent, charitable, and scientific institutions exemption. And it's about $195 million was the most recent estimate for the biennium. Working down the list, we have property of religious organizations, the next largest, child care facilities, schools, and student housing. And then rounding out some of the larger ones, the nonprofit corporate low-income housing and property of fraternal organizations. And I mention these ones because in a lot of the literature I've been looking at, they do try to categorize the different exemptions that are out there for nonprofit corporations. And usually the categories you see are religious, education, health industry, which would include hospitals and the such, nonprofits aimed at housing, and then there's usually an other category, which is a lot of other different things. And 307.130 can catch a little bit of all of those. It's a bit of a catch-all statute, of course. Religious organization statute is going to grab most of that. But if you're a nonprofit corporation and you are charitably aimed, you can fall under this 307.130 statute. So it really is a rather broad one, and that's part of the reason we intend to focus on this one statute. But so just a brief overview of what we think. The most likely this is going to be a paper and a couple other deliverables. But what we see right now is the scope of the study going forward is really to provide that background on the different exemptions available to nonprofit corporations, hit a little bit on other states. Hopefully, right now I think the initial plan is to go into more detail on what other states are doing, maybe do a few case studies, because this is one takeaway or one thing I would have members remember is this is not just Oregon specific. Oregon's not the only state that's struggling with this. In one way, shape, or form, all 50 states have an exemption from property tax related to nonprofit charitable corporations. So the initial plan right now, I think, is to maybe pick a few states that can be examples of the different policy changes or different ways in which maybe they've gone on making changes in recent legislation of shifting from a different policy perspective or even trying to clean up the legislative language, see what we can glean from other states there. The examination, I guess it really starts with the legal overview, and I'll touch very briefly on that. I have kind of almost a cheat sheet for the members to take a look at, because that's part of the issue, if you will, that comes up a lot of times, is it is a broad exemption, so the legal interpretation, I suppose, can vary is a way to describe it, or because it's so broad, it really is a common law approach that informs that, and I'll go into a little bit of detail that in just a couple minutes. But part of the underlying reason, I suppose, for the study is to try to unpack the exemption. Like I showed earlier, it's about $195 million estimated revenue loss. The information that is used by the Department of Revenue in putting those estimates together for the governor's tax expenditure report is a single line item that comes from each individual counties. So there really isn't any information to say, okay, of that $195 million, how much goes to this type of nonprofit or this type and so forth. It's just one line item. So that's all the information we have. So step one would be trying to unpack that a little bit, maybe explain, well, of that revenue loss, how much goes here, how much goes there, and then also just for our own benefit on the LRO side is to try to be able to put together a data set, and this is going to depend upon close work with the county assessors, that would allow us to not only unpack the exemption, but also then hopefully be able to model any potential changes, because right now the information that we have is pretty limited at a high level. So if we can put something more detailed together, we'll be able to have better output for you all to answer those questions. And so that's I guess, a pretty rough overview of what we expect the deliverable to contain. Like I said, hopefully you can get into some case studies of other states. I've done a little bit of research in that area already, and there's definitely some good information, I suppose, to be gleaned from what other states are doing. And then, like I said, this would be delivered, we think, prior to the 2017 long session and can also be helpful to all members, but also to inform the members of the work group. So we're having two members from the House, and then we have two members from the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee as well.
Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for this work and this thinking. I'm always unhappy with the term revenue loss when we talk about these as expenditures. So. It's how we choose to spend the money and what you're asking or suggesting, and we all agree that we should look more carefully at how those funds are being, quote, spent, end quote. So if we could go to your quantitative, qualitative description of exemption, can you expand on that just briefly? Again, what that, you already told us what that meant, but I need a broader explanation, because that's how the money's being, quote, spent, isn't it?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, Representative Vance, I think that'd be exactly the idea, and it definitely to your point. Tax expenditure is a term. It is in statute, which helps to inform exactly how it's defined, but it's a little bit of a term of art. Certainly, whether you want to view it as spending or it's more of a tax administration, that's why that exemption exists. But I think from the quantitative would be to try to just break that number down, that $195 million, let's just break that down a little bit. And then qualitative would be to more describe what it is, what are the type of organizations maybe that are qualifying, what they have to do to qualify, and try to explain those two and hopefully bring that two together to come full circle, really have a full description of the exemption that's available.
Follow up.
Yes, please.
Yes, okay, well, describing a church, there's a church. What's the church doing? They're describing a hospital, there's a hospital. That doesn't do much. What's the hospital doing? How do we get past that initial label and into the actual use of the money, if you will, that we're not choosing to take from them? Because the whole idea, isn't it, that this organization is doing what we as a government would otherwise have to do. So in this study, is it going to show us how those monies are being spent to accomplish what we would otherwise have to do with bringing the money through the door and then spending it on education, but instead we allow a parochial school to provide that service? I'm just asking, will your study bring that measure in for what it is that these funds are being spent for, or the picture of them, or something? That's why I took your qualitative, quantitative words to me.
Yeah, Chair Barnhart, Representative Vance. That is one of the things I should have mentioned that up front. The point, or the way we've seen it this way, is I don't see the paper by LRO being able to answer the question of, are these a good policy or are they not? But hopefully it can help to inform that for sure. I've looked at, in some of the different literature, and it talks about the different rationales for these exemptions existing, and there's a number of different ones. Part of that is definitely the example of, well, without these nonprofits, the state would have to step in to provide these services. So we can definitely talk about the different reasons, both historically and currently. And then I think to your point of, well, what are the nonprofits doing? There are some studies out there that hit a little bit on that. I don't see it right now, but certainly this is one of those things where it's like it's still under development, exactly what the final report will look like. But trying to explain exactly, okay, hospitals are receiving this type of exemption to use, to continue with that example. Of the information that's out there and publicly available could definitely include some of that, but it becomes a pretty, I'm not sure we're in a great position to be the ones to talk about the services that the nonprofits are providing at a really detailed level. I think it's definitely can bring in the outside literature, some of the academic literature that's out there that discusses these things, that talk to those points, but I'm not sure, in sense of when I think of the data set, I don't think we'd have nonprofit A and then we'd have, here's their revenue, the revenue loss potentially, and then talk about all their services and have them listed or anything like that, like a database or something to that detailed level.
I'll follow.
Yes, please.
Really is getting what the committee needs to do, but thank you, Mr. Chair. The issue is, will your report say more than a hospital, the word, and leave it up to us or the committee to try to sort out what it is that a hospital does that should enjoy this exemption? Or will you, well, that's what I'm getting at. Will your report dig in deeper than just the phrase church, hospital, school? That's what I'm doing now.
Representative Vance, I think that's part of the discussion is with the four members that we have kind of advising us. I think it would be, I think we're nimble enough to be able to try to include the things that will be most helpful to members. And that's certainly the type of questions I've been getting as we put these things on a list from the nonprofit community asking, are you going to be trying to answer these questions and how do you expect to do that? Yeah, I think it's definitely an ongoing. This is just an initial framework that we have put together.
Thank you.
But I would say in the interest of time, we only have a few minutes here. I would probably just skip down to one of my last slides. This is the I'll call the cheat sheet, if you will, that sets up. I mentioned this earlier. It is a very broad statute, this 307.130. So it really is a common law approach that informs whether a nonprofit receives this exemption or not. And what I mean by that is the different court decisions over the years helps to inform the qualification criteria. And if you look at the rules that Department of Revenue put together around this, they do read in a lot of ways like a summation of the different court cases over the years. But I probably don't have time to go step through this specifically. I'll try to do it really briefly at a high level. But the idea is it's two primary questions that have to be answered initially. And the first is the entity a charitable institution? And if the answer is no to that, then that's it. They don't get the exemption. But if the answer is yes, they are charitable, then the second question is the property actually and exclusively occupied or used in the charitable work carried on by the organization? And this is part of the reason why you can see charitable nonprofits could have property that is on the roll and taxable. And that goes to part of that question number two that has to be answered is it being actually used by the charitable entity? So it's not, the bar isn't where do those dollars flow, it's is that specific property being used to support that nonprofit corporation's charitable activities?
Of course, that's the current question. Following up on Representative Bence's question, and I think perhaps editorial comment, we might ask, is that the right question, set of questions to be asked? And we've asked this work group to do quite a bit of work on figuring that out. Other questions? Yes, I'm sorry, Representative Langer.
Thank you so much for giving this presentation. I think your table shows that it's a good $400 million, it appears, in expenditures that we make through these property tax exemptions. And as another person who's on this work group, I'm really excited to work with you. Hopefully, we can convene it. I defer to Chair Barnhart on the timing for this, but hopefully we can convene it quite soon so that we can help shape, as the legislators who will be trying to make sure we come up with a compromise that we can all support, or many, a majority of us can support in 2017, that we shape your inquiries in a way that will be most fruitful for us to be able to reach that kind of a consensus.
Yes. One of the things to be aware of, and I suspect without knowing for sure that Representative Benz is thinking about this too, is that in the broad scope of things, we have these very, very old common law rules that, as you point out, are embodied in the statutes and in the court decisions. The world has changed. The economic situation has changed a lot. And we take on these old common law rules at our peril. But at the same time, if we don't at least talk about them and decide whether they still continue to make sense or not, then we miss a bet. So good luck.
Yes,
as you work on this,
Mr. Chair, I would just point really quickly. There is a list of the different law changes, and it does point to the fact that this statute actually predates Oregon statehood. It began in 1854.
I'm not at all surprised.
Yes.
And of course, if you go back a ways, if you go back to other states, I think you find that the statute, even the language in the statute, probably is very old. I'll bet you find language that's very similar to this almost 1,000 years ago in England. I'm making that up, but I'd be astounded if that weren't true.
The exemption did probably come across the Atlantic,
yeah.
Yes.
All right. Anything else today? Paul.
Mr. Chair, I just want to remind the committee that we are meeting again December 2nd.
What time?
Via 8:30. It'll be meeting with the Senate Revenue Committee. And it'll be for the release of the December forecast.
Right.
We also have a report that you required us to give to you by December 1 on alternatives to tax reform. We'll have that for you as well. So that'll be December 2nd in this room.
That's right. And
8:30.
One of the things to be aware of is that I'm really loath to spend money without getting full return for it. So I keep lobbying for a full day for the Revenue Committee since we're here anyway. So far, I continue to lose those discussions. But please don't plan something for the early part of the afternoon yet, because we may actually be continuing to meet.
I'm almost positive I won't be here.
Yeah.
For at all.
Yeah.
Well,
work obligation.
Some of us will be gone. Fortunately, we will not be taking action on anything, and so a quorum consists of whoever shows up. But please, as many as possible. These reports we get from the state economist are pretty important for us as we plan for the 16th session. And of course, the next big one will be the middle of February when we help the Ways and Means Committee figure out what adjustments have to be made in the budget.
Yeah, it'll be
anything else? Paul, thank you for the scheduling. It's perfect, and we are on time, and the committee is adjourned.
This thing on my calendar.
I know.